Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff. This week on the show, we are living up to our name. It's the Weekly Stuff Podcast. We've been off for a week. Sean is very tired.
I'm extraordinarily tired, yes.
So I'm sorry, Sean. We've both been busy. My semester in college is over. Your semester teaching high school is not quite over.
No, yeah. I have one more week. I'm in finals, and so it has been a fast and furious couple of weeks of grading papers and getting all of them ready for the semester being over, because teenagers are a hassle.
I didn't know.
Yes, yeah. Especially when you have to deal with like 80 of them.
Maybe next week we can just swap some stories about school this year, but not this week. This week we are playing catch up. We've got a bunch of news. We learned this week who might be playing Batman in the next Batman movie. We got a new Spider-Man trailer. We got our first look at HBO's Watchmen. We got some breaking Call of Duty news about next year's game just about half an hour before we recorded. Nintendo had a direct about Mario Maker 2, and then I'm going to talk about Game of Thrones. I'm going to bitch about it. Sean is going to help me work through these feelings.
Yep. Like last podcast, I have continued to like just get absorbing all this Game of Thrones information. I sort of eavesdropped on what was basically an hour-long conversation between two teachers in the room next to mine, talking about the last episode. This episode we're going to talk about Game of Thrones. While I was grading papers, and it was very amusing. It was a good way to just, like, every 15 minutes, I kind of check out a grade of the paper and listen to another. It's like, what the fuck are they talking about? Oh, okay, I guess that happened in that episode.
It's like you had a live spoiler cast in the background.
It was pretty great.
And then I have been playing the game Cuphead. Cuphead came out back in 2017. Neither of us played it. It's now on Switch, and it has been the number one game on the Switch eShop for like a month and a half now. Mm-hmm. So it's cleaning the fuck up. I have put 25 hours into Cuphead so far.
I didn't have the impression that it was that long of a game.
If you're bad at it.
Okay.
So I'm going to talk about that. You've got Mafia 3. I've got something on the outline that just says Sean's anime adventures, so that's exciting.
Yeah, I mean, that's what, I mean, really the episode today is going to be about me breaking down for you, Jonathan, the most relevant topic in 2019, which is the bonkers fucking plot of the show called Armored Trooper Bottoms. So look forward to that when we get to the end of the show.
I think it's going to be good. I think Game of Thrones is going to bring us down, and I think that's going to bring us up and send us out on a high note.
Some fucking shit. I need to get off my chest.
Awesome. So yeah, we are not reviewing any movies this week. There have been some big ones. I have seen them, Detective Pikachu and John Wick 3. You have not?
No, I have not had the time.
So that'll be next week, probably.
Yes.
And I will just say about those, Detective Pikachu, I really liked even more than I actually thought I would. I think particularly the second half of that movie is really good and surprising. And John Wick 3, if there is a god, and if that god is into action movies, John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum is the face of God. Sean, there are scenes in this movie that I never thought I would see in an American action movie. Like that I didn't think Hollywood could pull off, is all I will say. Like scenes where I'm like, Jackie Chan would love this.
Uh-huh. That sounds good.
It's, oh my God. And also, this will excite you, Sean. The trailers have shown you nothing.
Great.
They're kind of like Avengers Endgame in how much they are making you look one way and not think about all the stuff that's actually in the movie that they are not even teasing. It's so fucking good. Oh my God. So yeah, I don't want to tease you too much because you haven't seen it. But it was very good. And I'm glad. I am back in Colorado, I should say.
Yes, so if the podcast sounds slightly different, that is the reason why.
Yeah, so, and I got to see John Wick 3 here in Colorado, where we have good theaters with good sound, and that was very nice.
Well, I was hoping to find another story about that shit theater and, like, everything being broken again.
You know, I did see Detective Pikachu. Okay, I have one for you.
Okay, great.
Because I saw Detective Pikachu back in Iowa. And I went to another, so I've been kind of like, with each new movie coming out, I'm trying different theaters in the area to get a feel for all the different theaters.
Uh-huh.
And this time I went over to Coralville. Coralville is like our sister town. It's like the suburbs of Iowa City become Coralville. And so there's a theater near me that is, our big chain in Iowa is Marcus Theaters. And there's one near me, and that's the one I've told you all the stories about.
Yes.
There is another Marcus Theaters in Coralville called the Coral Ridge Mall Theater. And I went to that one. And that one is, I had heard from my friends at school that the Coral Ridge one is nicer. And it is. Like, the sound was better. There was better, like, seals on the auditorium, so there was less sound bleed from, like, Avengers next door. Because Avengers is a louder movie than Detective Pikachu, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
And so there was less sound bleed. I think the projection was slightly nicer, all of that. But I get there about half an hour early because I haven't been to this theater before. There's no reserved seating, and it's opening night for a Pokemon movie. It was going to be, and the theater did, like, sell out. So I get there about half an hour, like, come in, and, like, where I would like to sit, which is, like, the back of the front section is open. I'm like, perfect. And I sit down, and I feel like, oh, God. And it's like, I go back too far because the seat is kind of broken.
Okay,
and I'm
great.
Like, this isn't really comfortable. Like, it's, like, you have to be so reclined. It felt bad. Like, there's a level of reclining where I'm like, I don't want to do that.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't, like, to sit forward, I would have to, like, lean forward, not just sit up straight. It was so weird. So I'm like, okay, this seat's clearly broken, right, Sean?
Yeah.
So I get up and just try the one right next to me. Same thing. Okay. I try the row in front of me. Same thing. I try across the aisle, because there's an aisle in the middle, row next to the... Same thing. All the seats, I don't know if they're broken or if they were constructed that way, but they are all like this. And at this point, I feel like an idiot because I've tried like 5 seats and people are looking at me funny.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I'm just gonna sit where I was and deal with it. But it was kind of weird. And yeah, it's an older, you know, mall theater. So I don't know if it's just every seat was broken or if that's how the seats are supposed to be. And it's probably a little of column A, a little of column B.
Yeah, and yeah, that's probably that they were not super well designed in the first place, and then they've been used so much that all of them are kind of at the end of their lives.
Yeah, so, you know, Marcus Theaters, you're trying your best, it's fine, you know. They have one nice thing about Marcus Theaters, is some of them, is that they let you fill your own drinks, which means they don't, like, you can just get as many refills as you want.
That's nice.
Which is nice for a drive home. Except when you do it for Avengers, and Avengers is 3 hours long, and you get out at 11, and you have a 30-minute drive back, and so you get a second Mountain Dew thinking, caffeine doesn't affect me that much, and then you don't go to sleep after Avengers until 4 in the morning. Because that's what happened to me after Avengers Endgame.
Interesting.
We're on a tangent now.
Yes.
But yeah, I am in Colorado. I did not bring you a Spider-Man comic this time, Sean.
Oh.
And I do feel bad. I was going to...
don't feel bad about that. That's a weird thing to feel bad about.
I feel bad for the podcast tradition.
Okay.
Because I was meaning to do it in Iowa, forgot to go to the comic shop. Then yesterday I was over by where we used to have a comic shop, Mile High Comics, and it's gone now.
Oh, is it?
The one near on Kipling, or on Wadsworth at least, is gone.
I've not been over that way recently.
Which made me sad. I guess there's one down in Denver that's bigger, but...
Yeah, that's like the main Mile High Comics.
Okay, yeah. And I didn't want to go down to Denver to buy a stupid Spider-Man comic.
No, yes, again, don't go out of your way to do that.
It's a fun joke when it takes no effort for
exactly,
me.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, we're going to talk about all this. Sean, we're going to save most of our big stuff for later, like a Cuphead, Game of Thrones, your anime, all of that. Armor Trooper Vadums, okay. Do you have any stuff to talk about at the top before we hit the news?
Because the last time we talked, I was at the very beginning of Mafia 3, so I want to kind of expand on my thoughts from that discussion, because I have continued to play that game since. And I guess one thing I do want to say about it that is really nice is a very good game to play in very short bursts.
Mm.
So it's been something that's been nice for me right now where I do not generally have long stretches of time that I can dedicate to just playing one video game. Because the way that Mafia 3 is structured is it's stratified really aggressively because there's just lots of different like little sections of the game, which makes it so that you can... in a very short play session, accomplish something that feels very significant to your overall goal. And so you can play for like 30 minutes and put it down and be like, oh, I made some like significant progress. Because the way, once you get past the sort of opening phase, the way the game is structured is you have your ultimate goal of taking down Sal Marcano, who's the sort of main Italian mafia dude who betrayed you at the beginning of the game. That's obviously what happens at the very, very end is you're going to end up taking that asshole down. And to do that, you have constructed a sort of team of 3 lieutenants that are 3 that kind of are control 3 different sections of the city that have all been fucked over by Marcano in some way. So you kind of bring them together and bring their kind of sub gangs under your group so that they will help you take out Marcano. And so as you go through the game, you take over districts and assign it to one of your 3 lieutenants. And depending on who you assign districts to, you get different upgrades and stuff like that, which is pretty cool. And so you have that, and you're constantly building up those upgrades and your relationships with your 3 lieutenants. And to do that, you take down people in Marcano's gang that are controlling different districts of the city. And so that's your sort of like A to B to C goals. You're like ultimately trying to take down these Marcano lieutenants to knock him down the peg till you can take him out, kind of like a Crackdown or something, like one of those games that has a similar structure. But then each of the districts controlled by a lieutenant is kind of split into two separate mission types that you have to complete a certain number of those mission types to then take out a hideout. So each district kind of has two sub-objectives that you need to complete before you can take down the lieutenant. Then taking down the lieutenant then opens up another district you can go after, and then after you take out that district, then that gives you, like, the... After you've done those, that gives you the opening to Marcano. And so it's stratified out to, like, such a specific degree that you can basically clear out one of the sub-objectives of a district in about 30 minutes, which makes it a really satisfying game to play in small chunks, which is why I suspect the game had really mixed reception from critics when it came out. It was probably because if you binged this game, you'd get bored of it in like 3 hours because you'd just be doing the same thing over and over and over again. If you're picking it up for about 30 minutes a night, though, you're clearing out one of those sub-objectives and being like, awesome, like I feel totally satisfied. I went and I murdered like 50 dudes and I drove my car around all crazy around the city and burned a bunch of shit, threw a bunch of grenades, and then I'm good for tonight. Then you start up the process again the next day. So for people who are looking for a game like that and looking for, like, you know, you don't necessarily need to play the newest game, Mafia 3 is really, really good for that. And then also just in general, I think it is a really, really well-playing game. All the stuff of the feeling of the combat and the driving is so much fucking fun. Because especially if you are like me and you really like playing the Uncharted games like an absolute asshole, and you're just blind firing around every corner and jumping around and just being a maniac.
As God intended.
Yes, exactly. As God intended. That's sort of like what Mafia 3 is. It's except for Mafia 3 is like that, only it's just a lot more violent to sort of fit the darker tone of the game. But each shot has so much impact, and there's such a sense of sort of weight behind your character, Lincoln Clay, because you're just this big fucking beefed up Vietnam vet that you're going around murdering all these assholes, and you're just so much stronger and faster and better than all these pricks, and so you're just murdering the shit out of them. And one of the best things about the game is that it has these really overdramatic hit reacts on every shot you take. So most enemies drop in 2 to 3 shots from just like a normal pistol. But if you shoot them once, they're basically completely fucked because it takes them like a full second to recover from just being shot in the leg or whatever. So you're just playing on the normal difficulty. If you have your wits about you, most people don't really stand much of a chance against you, but that feels tuned appropriately for what the game wants as the sort of gritty revenge kind of like pseudo blaxploitation kind of vibe they're going for. Just that sense of slamming behind cover and then just like taking out your like army Colt 45 and just blasting 7 shots, blind firing around the corner. And yeah, 4 of those shots miss, but 3 of them hit the dude in the chest and he just like, go, 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 and then falls backwards over the railing. And it's like, that's fucking awesome. And as long as I'm not spending 5 hours just doing that over and over in one day and I'm just breaking into little chunks, it feels awesome every single time I do it. So nice. Mafia 3 has just proved to be kind of the perfect game for me, like right at this moment, and I feel very fortunate that I just like randomly decided to check out what I had unlocked on like PS Plus stuff. It's like, oh shit, right, Mafia 3. That game, people said that was good, even though the reviews are very mixed. I'll check that out, and it is a fun fucking game.
It's probably good when like you're grading papers and you've seen the its versus its mistake for the 60th time, and God, then you're like, what?
Jonathan, you're grading college papers. You have no fucking clue. You have no idea. Don't you come to me with that shit.
The joke was that Mafia is the perfect way to let off steam, I'm imagining.
Yes. Yeah, because you're shooting dudes with all these like semiotic matic rifles and stuff. That's one of the other things that's really fun about the shooting in the game is that the weapon selection for most of the game is it's actually you're mostly firing a lot of like World War II era guns, which makes sense because, you know, these are like the guns that would have proliferated among like, you know, the organized crime in the city. It's not necessarily... Not everyone's going to have a fucking M16 or whatever because those are the weapons they're using over in Nam. So it's mostly you're firing stuff like Thompson submachine guns and like there's an M1 Garand equivalent because they... Actually, one thing I do like about the game is that none of the guns are branded, which means that you can have a good conscience playing this game because you know that they did not pay gun manufacturers a bunch of money to license the names for the guns, which if you didn't know that that's what that is, that's what that is. So like, you know... the gun manufacturers get a lot of money every time a Call of Duty comes out, because you can't use the name of the gun unless you pay the manufacturer of the gun.
You just blew the name. You just blew my mind.
Yeah,
I should have known that,
mm-hmm.
but I hadn't thought about it.
It's, yeah,
yeah.
So there are just some shooters like Counter-Strike. I'm pretty sure Uncharted uses fake gun names also, and this game uses fake gun names. But you can very easily tell if you play Call of Duty 2 or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this is the M1 Garand. It does the thing where it goes ping, and the little like thing pops out when you reload. So yeah, but, and that makes it so it is. It's fun because the weapons feel like old and kind of fucked up, and you know, it has that really impactful feel of using a lot of bolt action rifles in that era of weaponry. You just very rarely play games that have that kind of stuff in it. It was one of the things that also felt refreshing about Red Dead Redemption 2, was just like, oh great, not every single gun in this game is just a fucking assault rifle. There's a greater sense of variety.
So, Sean, now that I know that they license guns the way they license cars,
uh-huh.
when are we going to get the Xbox presser where they from the ceiling, they lower down, like, a bunch of dudes, like, in body armor just carrying all the guns from that year's Call of Duty?
God, yeah, like, if there was just one gun manufacturer that was just infamous for, like, Beretta or someone just would never license people their fucking guns to
yeah.
shit. And so it's like, and this year we finally have the Beretta, blah, 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 blah. And then, yeah, they lower it down from a fucking crane onto the stage. Yeah, thank God that it's not quite like that.
Not yet.
Not yet. Yeah, we'll be there eventually. Don't worry.
All right. On my stuff list, I have an item called, I replaced my Xbox One with a VCR. So I'm going to tell that story.
Okay, I think that's maybe the only time that sentence has ever been said. That's a very unique construction of words there.
Okay, so let me tell you how I arrived at this sentence. So I have been trying to ascertain an old VCR tape machine for a while now, because at Iowa, where I'm doing my PhD, our library has a really good collection of VHS tapes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you don't know, there's a lot of stuff that never made the jump from VHS to DVD, which never made the jump from DVD to Blu-ray to digital, all of that. Particularly, actually, if you're doing film studies, there's a lot of silent films that got, like, VHS releases that just never have come out again. Like Eric von Stroheim's Greed is a famous one. But yeah, so and there's just other stuff, like, you know, Disney has often, like, altered their films pretty heavily on DVD, and some of them it's cool to see the versions that you knew as a kid on tape. So, like, I hadn't been, like, working hard at this, but every couple weeks I would stop by, like, a Goodwill. I'm also looking for a couch, which I haven't found yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just, you know, look around, see what they had, and this a couple weeks ago, they finally had, like, a VCR that was a good price, like, $10, which is perfect. And it's like, okay, this is great. And this will work. And I brought it home. Works great. They also at there's a lot of places in Iowa that just sell VHSs, like Goodwill stores and like thrift stores like that. Just have stacks of tapes, and they'll sell them to you like 3 for $1. So it's a very cheap way to watch some movies in very shitty quality. But anyway, so I did. I got this VCR. I bought a couple of tapes, and I was like, this is great. I bring it home, and I realize my entertainment center is kind of full. And I'm like, what here is the same shape as a VCR? Xbox, you're gone. You're not even plugged in right now. I take the Xbox off. The VCR is slightly smaller. Put it in the spot. And I wasn't even really thinking about it at that point. I set it all up. It's working. I'll tell the story in a little bit. But then later I was on the phone with my brother, Thomas, and I said, oh, yeah, I got this VCR. I put it where the Xbox was. And he burst out loud. He's like, you replaced your Xbox One with a VCR. I'm like, I guess I did. I didn't think about it. He said, that's very symbolic.
Yeah.
And it is. My Xbox is sitting sadly under a table. On some carpet.
I mean, you said you were looking for a couch just to sit on your Xbox One.
It's big enough.
Padding.
Yeah. Yeah. So yes, my Xbox One has been replaced with a VCR, which I feel like, I don't know, that should be like an ad that Sony puts out at this year's E3, like opposite whatever Xbox shows off, is some douchey college kid, me, replacing their Xbox One with a VCR. But you and I both grew up in that era where we definitely had a lot of experience with tapes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then DVD came in. Like, I probably didn't have a DVD player till like 2001, I think.
Yeah, I think it was probably a little bit longer for us, like 2002 or 3.
Yeah, so it was a while. And even then, once you had DVD, most DVD players were also VHS players.
Yes, yeah.
And then you would still get, because they were everywhere, right? So, you know, I have a certain nostalgic fondness for VHSs, and it was, I will admit, I did just, because these, I got it at Goodwill, there's no remote, so if I want to, like, use the buttons, I have to, like, sit down next to my VCR. And I did have a fun time, just, I had a stack of tapes that I've collected over the years, and then just that I bought at Goodwill, putting them in, doing the rewinding, playing, doing the really fucking cool VCR rewinding where you just see it all moving with the scan lines and everything. I love all of that. It was funny. It you know, just using normal AV cables, I was able to hook it up to my widescreen TV. Totally fine. No problem. Stereo sound output. The sound on VHS tapes is actually fucking great. It's very clear, loud, well-balanced analog sound. I would like, not as good as like a vinyl or something, but definitely like it sounds really nice and crisp. The video quality is terrible because it's VHS. But there's also
because it's VHS and it's like they're all like old used VHS tapes. So it's like you're not putting in like some pristine newly printed fucking VHS tape of The Lion King or some shit.
No.
It's like this is some old beat up old fucking VHS tapes.
Yeah, and so you know, it doesn't look great, but there's also like I think if you come from the like era we do or earlier, there's a nostalgia to it.
Oh,
and
yeah, absolutely.
There's a real charm to it.
I mean, that's like, you know, I still have probably like a dozen, well, not a dozen is probably a bit much, probably like 8 or so Godzilla movies on tape because that's what I watched all the time as a kid. So like I still have like Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla and like Son of Godzilla and all of those on VHS tapes. So when I think of tapes, I think of The Lion King and I think of Godzilla.
Yes.
Those are the ones I watched all the time.
The Lion King, I learned, was the highest selling VHS of all time.
Yes.
That's why there were 8 copies at my Goodwill and I was able to pick which one looked like it was in the best condition.
Uh-huh.
But I, you know, I did, I bought all 3 Aladdin movies at Goodwill because they had Aladdin and then its 2 direct-to-video sequels, The Return of Jafar and Aladdin and the King of Thieves, which is the one Robin Williams came back for. And it's actually pretty good as direct-to-video sequels go. But I watched all 3 of those on tape again because the new Aladdin movie is coming out.
Of course.
And one, Disney movies are so much more enjoyable on tape. And it's 2 things. It's just the nostalgia of it, of like, this. I banged the table, sorry.
Yes, very passionate.
Very passionate. One is the nostalgia of it, like, this is how Disney movies looked to us in our youth. Like, when I think of The Lion King, Sean, The Lion King is not in widescreen to me.
Uh-huh.
It is a 4x3 VHS movie, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think there's some of that, it's just this is how we saw it. But also, if you haven't followed this, like, Disney, over the years, fucked with their movies so much on DVD, and much, much worse on Blu-ray, where they, like, they just did all this. It's not even as bad as doing digital noise reduction. They would go in and, like, you can see features on this where they would, like, Photoshop out elements from, like, the, like, to separate the cells and then clean underneath and then, like, reconstruct it. So they're essentially reconstructing the movies and getting rid of any trace that they were ever captured on film, which, of course, destroys a lot of the detail in the image.
Yeah.
So, frankly, I kind of just like the look of Disney's movies on VHS better because it's shittier quality, but it is truer to how the movies were animated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, there's something about the way cell animation, the way characters move in cell animation, that in a super, like, cleaned up DVD where they've scrubbed out all the grain, the character's movement looks very weird to me. But if it's on tape and there is grain and it is an analog image, it looks much more naturalistic because that's what the animators were expecting.
Yeah.
Tape or film are siblings. The tape is the very, very little brother of actual 35mm film. But that was fun. The Return of Jafar, Aladdin 2, is not very good, but it is, like, all Iago all the time. And I am kind of fond of Gilbert Gottfried's Iago.
I feel like Iago is effective, as with most Gilbert Gottfried stuff, in very short bursts.
He has 2 full song numbers.
That's horrifying. I'm sure I feel like I have seen Return to Jafar, or Return of Jafar, but I have absolutely no memory. I mean, honestly, I have very little memory of Aladdin, because I don't think I've seen Aladdin since I was like 10 or something.
Yeah, it's, you know what? Worth watching again. I like Aladdin a lot. The original Aladdin, like, of the Disney Renaissance movies, I think it's probably my favorite. I just really like the characters. I really like the animation. I love the songs. Like, and Robin Williams as the genie obviously is just the best character of that era.
Mm-hmm.
And it really held up for me. Because some of those Disney Renaissance movies like Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid, those do not hold up to me. Lion King does in places and not in others. Aladdin was just all 90 minutes. I was like, I'm into this. I really like this. But yeah, it's fun. I was able to pick up, they had just the entire Indiana Jones trilogy on tape.
Nice.
There's something, Indiana Jones totally looks good on tape because like that's kind of what it's those are like pulpy, beat up ass movies. There's something about, even if they're cropped and everything, like I've never fully been able to enjoy Raiders of the Lost Ark on Blu-ray because I have seen that movie projected on 35mm so many times that it's way too clean. On Blu-ray. On VHS, I'm like, yeah, this looks perfect. Other than that they've cropped the sides off. But that's how we dealt with it back in the day, you know? So yes, my Xbox One is sitting under a table. There's a VCR there. I'm excited to get back to Iowa and play with my stupid tape machine. I will tell you, with Aladdin in particular, I had the Aladdin DVD out, but I was instead watching the VHS tape. I've never felt more like a hipster.
Yeah, that's extreme.
Yeah.
What is there like a VHS tape or a couple of VHS tapes that you're like really desperate to find?
No, because I've been very casual about it. Like, part of this was also I was at a store where someone had a bunch of old Dragon Ball Z tapes.
Oh, cool.
And I got several of those. And I really just got them for the art, because the old DBZ tapes Funimation did have these, like, if you put them all together, there's a big banner art on the side that's just cell art from the show. And it's really looks nice. But I did pop in a couple of those, and it was kind of funny because it totally felt like watching it on Toonami back in the day, because that's the version that's on tape.
Exactly, yeah.
And it totally looks better than Funimation's current Blu-rays of Dragon Ball Z, so that's one thing. But yeah, is there one I really want to find? Not really, because this is the other thing, is that I feel like most movies you want on tape, there were so many tapes, they're not all that rare.
Hmm.
Like, I don't know, like, because there were a couple, like, I would like to get some of the Star Wars tapes now.
Yeah.
I'm sure I have some of those around somewhere, but finding some of those again. But again, there's a million Star Wars tapes.
We definitely have the like special edition, like the first special edition tapes that came out on VHS. So,
yeah. I actually liked those because, one, the 97 special editions are the best of the special editions.
Mm-hmm.
And they have some fun featurettes on them that are good. Yeah.
Which is like, it's always, I remember it being weird because I feel like we got those tapes after we had a DVD player or when we had like a VHS DVD hybrid. And so I was used to watching DVDs, and the idea of like VHS tapes that had special features that you had to like fast forward through or rewind past. It's like, what the fuck is this? I'm so used to picking things on a menu. Like, there's just special features baked into that you have to like go past if you want to watch the movie.
It's wild. There's always like a million trailers, but you would have had to do that because Star Wars didn't come out on DVD until 2004.
Yes.
The original movie. So we had to watch them on tape forever. I'd love to find, so I was able to get at Goodwill. They had some of the Lord of the Rings tapes.
We have those.
Yeah. So I grabbed Fellowship of the Ring and Return of the King. Return of the King had to be split across two tapes, which was fun. I kind of put that. I put in tape two just to see where it started and everything. The other fun thing is that if you buy used tapes, sometimes they're not rewound fully, and it is a fun guessing game to just put in a movie and be like, where is this going to start?
Uh-huh.
You don't get that with DVD, right? And but I did not remember this. The extended cuts of Lord of the Rings all came out on tape in widescreen. I'd love to grab at least one of those just to kind of like see what that's like.
Yeah, I don't know where our, because we definitely, I remember at least having Return of the King, because I think we did that for like a trip or something where we had like a little TV with a VHS or VCR in it.
Oh man, I did that all the time back in the day, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's fun, and I definitely think I'm going to collect more of the Disney tapes, because those used to be pretty expensive because of all the Disney Vault stuff.
Uh-huh.
And now, again, they're like 30 fucking cents, you know. And there are some cool ones, like Fantasia, the version on tape is the only version that has the original narrator, Deems Taylor, who comes out and talks, because on the DVD and Blu-ray, they redubbed his voice with Corey Burton, the voice actor, because they were trying to show more of the footage, and not all the voice exists for it anymore, so they had to have someone else do the lines, and I don't like that. I wish they had just the, because if all that exists is the cut-down version, I kind of wish they would just give us the cut-down version. Because the animation isn't affected. It's just the live-action bits. But anyway, so I'll update you more on this. If anyone has a suggestion of what wacky tape I should find.
Yeah, there's just got to be some weird shit out there that just never came over in any other form. Or like weird versions of movies that are only on VHS.
Oh, here's one. The original three Dragon Ball Z movies, Dead Zone, World's Strongest, Tree of Might, did come out here as subtitled tapes.
Whoa.
And I've been trying to find one of those, and they're really hard to find on eBay because they, like the dubbed versions, there were many more of them, obviously.
Yeah, because I have a couple of those.
Yeah, but I would love to see like Dead Zone subtitled on tape would be a trip.
Yeah, that's weird. Like the idea of subtitles for like a full foreign movie that's subtitled on VHS is utterly foreign to me. Because obviously I wasn't watching a lot of those when I was like 7.
And they didn't put a lot out. I mean, usually if you had a dub, that's what would go on the tape.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, that's a fun story. Sorry, Xbox One. I'll play you again someday.
Maybe. I mean, we're getting pretty close to the end of this generation, Jonathan. Don't make promises if you know you can't keep them.
Good quote of a famous Xbox character who has not been relevant this generation.
Yeah, not since 2015, which is the last fucking Halo game.
Yes. And again, I just want to stress it is hilarious that the Xbox One, the launch model, is literally the size of a VHS player.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. All right. You want to do some news?
What's going on in the news, Jonathan?
Variety reported this weekend that Robert Pattinson, who you might know from the Twilight movies, but he's been in lots of other things, has reportedly been cast as Batman and Bruce Wayne in Matt Reeves' upcoming The Batman movie for WB. This is the one that's coming out in June of 2021. Matt Reeves, if you don't know, he's probably most famous these days. He did Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and War for the Planet of the Apes. So right away, I'm on board for whatever he wants to do. But this is the one that Ben Affleck was attached to at some point. Then Matt Reeves got on board and Ben Affleck left. And Matt Reeves has been working on the script.
I think the verb we want to use there is Ben Affleck escaped.
He escaped, yes. He got out while the getting was good. And clearly, like, as the indications have been, Matt Reeves is getting a clean slate for this. He's not having to do any DCEU stuff with it.
I mean, he's clearly not trying to cast for another version of the Ben Affleck Batman. No. Like, if you're casting Pattinson, that must be a very different take on the character.
So there were some conflicting reports because Variety said it's not a done deal, like no one signed the papers, but it's happening. They just have to do the paperwork. Mm-hmm. And then Deadline and The Hollywood Reporter said, hold up, it's probably Pattinson. They're also looking at Nicholas Hoult, who is playing J.R.R. Tolkien in the Tolkien biopic, and he is Beast in the young X-Men movies.
Yes. So you can see him as Beast in X-Men Dark Phoenix.
Yes. You know, so that could happen. Variety, I should say, has been really good about this movie lately. They've been in lockstep with WB and DC's messaging for a while now. Like, they had the scoop on Affleck dropping out of this. They had the scoop on Reeves taking over. They were given the scoop on this movie moving to 2021. So my assumption is that someone just leaked this to someone at Variety and that this is happening. And this is how WB kind of wanted to start percolating the information. If it doesn't happen, I'd be surprised. And I also just have to say, this is one of the only actors who I would know. Like, they could have gone with an unknown, but if they went with a name actor, this is one of the only actors who I would say I'm excited to see play this role.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like, I don't have nearly as much experience with, like, post-Twilight Robert Pattinson, which for people who don't know, he has had, like, a really rich career in, like, more independent movies.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen him in, like, a couple of things. I watched, like, half of The Lost City of Zed when we were on that cruise, like, a year or so ago. Like, I ended up catching about half of that because my brother was watching it. And he was really good in that. And, yeah, like, it's just, I get that there are people that are like, this is, like, even probably more than getting Matt Reeves, this makes me way more interested in this Batman movie than, like, anything. Because it says that they're going in probably what is going to be a more interesting direction if they're casting Pattinson. Like,
absolutely.
It just seems like it's going to be a different kind of Batman on film. I like that they're casting younger. Because the only context I particularly like old Batman in is if he has, like, there's, like, seven Robins and three Batgirls. It's, like, right, I want the whole extended Bat family because I want the whole history of Batman, like, in, like, Batman Arkham Knight or something, where you feel like this is an old Batman that's been on, like, a shit ton of adventures and he has all these other people that, you know, he's had all these interactions with. But if you're not going to do that, I would rather have it be a younger Batman, like, you know, in the, like, middle of his career or something.
Absolutely, and this is very reminiscent, I think, of Chris Nolan casting Christian Bale.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is you get someone who is just a fucking solid actor, first and foremost. Because I agree with everything you said. If you want to see a really... There's two movies streaming. They're both on Amazon Prime for free. And then one of them, Cosmopolis, is also on Vudu right now for free completely. You don't have to sign up for anything. But if you watch Cosmopolis, that is one of Pattinson's first big art house movies, and it was a David Cronenberg film. And it's really interesting. It's about, he plays like this young billionaire, like hedge fund manager, and the whole movie takes place basically in the back of his limousine as he tries to get across town to get a haircut. And like over the course of the day, like all of the stocks fall and everything. It's a very surreal movie. It's very much kind of like a stage play. I don't know if it's a great movie or not, but I was watching it and he is great in it. And I was like, I so want to see this guy play Bruce Wayne because the way he plays aloof billionaire in that movie is so fucking fascinating. I kind of just want them to take Cosmopolis and edit in Batman scenes because it would be fun. There's also a scene where like he gets a like rectal examination in the limousine from his doctor while he's talking to like a woman he's like flirting with. And it is the weirdest fucking like BDSM wild shit, and I really want them to have Bruce Wayne do that in the new movie with Catwoman. But anyway, so watch that. That's a great example of him as Bruce Wayne. The other movie I was going to mention that's on Amazon Prime is called Good Time. It's by the Safdie brothers. I have not seen that one yet, but I'm planning on watching it, and it was very acclaimed a couple years ago. So he's just a very solid actor, very much cut from the same cloth as Christian Bale, where he had success as like a younger actor, then went on kind of the art house route. Now he's like, you know what? I'm going to make some mortgage payments. Let's do Batman. And Christian Bale was 31 when he was cast for Batman Begins. Robert Pattinson is 33. So I think it's the exact model you want. And more than anything, I like that it is... It struck me as right because it was not the actor I would have expected.
Yeah.
But when you hear it, you're like, yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah, that's exactly what my reaction of like... Because like with most of these things, I see it like vaguely on Twitter... And it's like, is in, you know, because I saw it as a like joke someone made on, or what I thought was like, oh, is that supposed to be a joke on Twitter before I saw the actual news? And then so I was like, oh, no, that's actually real? Fucking awesome. That sounds great. That sounds so much better than like any other casting that I would have come up with.
Yes. Because it sounds like the kind of thing where you would be going through like the audition and looking at an actor's movies and you would come through it organically that way.
Yeah.
And I love that. You know, I said on Twitter, he has the three things you need out of Bruce Wayne. Is he's got the right kind of looks where he can pull off the double act of being Batman and Bruce Wayne. He's got this very piercing kind of intelligence behind his eyes where you can see him calculating. Cosmopolis is a good example of this. And you want that out of Batman. And then also, he's fucking weird. Uh-huh. And you need to be able to buy that this guy would go dress as a bat. And I think you can buy that Robert Pattinson, who's just a little too pale and a little too skinny, and he's very handsome but also kind of scary. Yeah, I buy that he would dress as a bat and beat people up. Why not?
Yeah, and maybe most important of all is he has a very big, distinctive chin.
Yes.
And so if you have to wear a cowl for, like, half of your fucking movie, you gotta have a dude that, like, looks good in that cowl.
Yes. So I think this is really good casting. I mourn for the couple of years where we're not going to get all the cool art house movies because he's going to be busy with this. But then he's going to have a shit ton of money to do whatever the hell he wants. So there you go.
Yeah.
Because that Twilight money didn't last forever, I assume.
Presumably not.
Presumably not. No, but yeah. And also, like, with the Twilight thing, he's good in Twilight. Like, yeah, I want to stress, like, the actors are not the problem with Twilight.
No, yeah. The source material is rough. Like, there's only so much you can do.
Yeah.
I will still stand by, like, I very much enjoyed when I watched the first Twilight movie, in on a number of different levels.
Yes. Hey, there is no Twilight movie as bad as Batman v Superman, or Suicide Squad.
Okay. I would definitely much rather watch fucking all the Twilight movies than watch fucking Batman v Superman again.
Absolutely, because, you know, you get to the end, and Twilight Breaking Dawn Part 2 starts with Kristen Stewart punching out a cougar. And that's entertaining.
Great.
Yeah. And also, someone said this on Twitter, they need to cast Kristen Stewart as the Joker. They need to do it. Make it weird and sexual between them. I want that. I want it so bad.
Oh my God. That would be... Yeah, no, that's good.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, just go weird with it is honestly what I would like from this Batman movie. We've had so much fucking Batman stuff. Just go weird with it, please.
It really sounds like they're finally... taking this shit seriously. Uh-huh. Where, like, it's like, okay, we really fucked up Batman. Let's do what we did back in, like, 2005. Interesting director, interesting actor, and let them do whatever the hell they want with it.
Yeah. I hope that it's a lot more comic booky than the Christopher Nolan movies. Like, in this sense, I don't necessarily mean, like, I want a lot of humor or I want necessarily, like, a Marvel movie tone from it, but I would like them to lean more into some of the weirder elements of the Batman universe, even if they want to go dark and gritty, because I'm sure they're going to go dark and gritty with it to a certain extent. But just, like, I want it to be a Batman where I can imagine that Ra's al Ghul, like, has come out of the fucking Lazarus pit. Like, that's what I want.
Oh, God. I would love Robert Pattinson's Batman versus a Ra's al Ghul.
Yes.
I could buy that. No, I agree. And you know, Matt Reeves did two fucking Planet of the Apes movies.
Exactly.
And I think that showed a certain penchant for being able to take very pulpy material and have it be grounded, but not ignore that it is pulpy, silly material. That's what you want probably out of Batman in 2020. You know?
Exactly, yeah. Like, if this was a bad... Like, I want this to be a thing where you could make a really great Batman movie where he fights the man bat, and that's the villain, right? Like, that's like... You should be able to do that. Christopher Nolan would never be able to make that movie.
Andy Serkis is the man bat in mocap.
Fucking yes, please. Yes, he could also be great as the scientist dude that turns into the man bat. Like, it would be great casting.
Oh, man. Now I want... Shit! Call us, WB. We've got ideas.
Yeah, if you can only use the same, like, five Batman villains in movies so many times. Like, eventually you have to do the Man-Bat movie. He was the villain in the first Batman animated series cartoon. If you can be a villain in that, you can be a villain in this.
Batman v. Man-Bat, Dawn of Fluttering. I don't know. Yeah. All right. Speaking of Batman, the CW this week ordered the Batwoman television show to series. This was Upfronts week, so all of the TV networks were showing off their stuff. CW is the only network that matters because they're the only ones that make good shows. And the CW showed off Batwoman. If you don't know, Arrow, which was the first show in their, what they call the Arrowverse, all of their DC comic shows on CW, Arrow is ending next season. And they're going to have a big crossover event, Crisis on Infinite Earths, that's going to wrap up Arrow and then also probably do some big stuff with Flash and Supergirl and Legends of Tomorrow. And Batwoman will come in to, like, replace Arrow, basically. And Batwoman was introduced in last year's crossover, Elseworlds, where we went to Gotham City and met Kate Kane as Batwoman. Ruby Rose, the actress, plays her. And that was, like, our first look. Then they did a pilot, and now they've ordered a series. At Upfronts, they showed a 3-minute trailer that is kind of like a cutdown of the pilot. And I would recommend watching it. It's very good. Ruby Rose, we already knew she was really good in this part from the Elseworlds crossover, but seeing her in her own, like, show looked really fun. If you don't know Ruby Rose, she's been in a lot of stuff. One thing you might know her from is John Wick Chapter 2.
Right,
yeah. She plays the silent assassin, and she's so fucking good in that. Because I just rewatched John Wick 2 before John Wick 3, and it's so good. And she looks really good in this. The trailer is, you know, it's a CW show. It's not going to be the most stylish thing in the world. They have to make, like, 22 of these a year. Mm-hmm. But it looked fun, you know, getting, like, a Gotham vibe. It's darker, but still feels like it'll fit in with the general vibe of the CW shows. I like that the way they kind of play with the whole gender aspect of Batman and Batwoman in the trailer is fun. And, you know, they go all fucking in on the suit. Giant head of red hair coming out the back. Big red bat symbol on the front. That's what we want. And also the trailer is gay as shit. And that's what you want out of Batwoman.
Yep.
You know, there's a scene where it's Kate Kane as Batwoman and then someone who might be a love interest or not, basically recreating one of the scenes with Kim Basinger from the 1989 Batman with Michael Keaton. And I'm just like, yeah, I love that we can get this on TV in 2019. The world is on fire, but we're going to get our gay Batwoman.
Yes.
That's what we deserve. It's good.
That's very good. I've not seen that trailer, but now I'm interested.
Yeah, and I'm excited to, because I'm all caught up. Flash is over for the season. I'm caught up on that. Supergirl has one episode left. I might try to catch up on some of Legends of Tomorrow over the summer because everyone says it's great. I'm watching a lot of CW superhero shows, and they're good, and we're going to get a new one, so that's nice. And unlike Arrow, it will not have 8 seasons I would need to catch up on if I were to watch it. So there we go. Speaking of superheroes, Spider-Man Far From Home got its second trailer, but it pretty much just should have been the first trailer.
Yeah, because, like, now the first trailer feels like, even though it was long enough to be a trailer, that first trailer feels like a teaser trailer compared to this one.
I am kind of genuinely curious why they didn't just hold off, because, like, Spider-Man's gonna sell. You don't need a 6-month marketing window.
Yeah.
And, like, that first trailer just has to fucking lie about the plot. And then this trailer is like, because this trailer starts with Tom Holland saying, hey, if you haven't seen Endgame, guys, this spoils Endgame, go see Endgame and then watch our trailer. And like, so it's the first trailer I've ever seen with a fucking spoiler warning on it. But then you see the trailer and like, yes, Peter is very sad about Tony Stark being dead. And they talk about the snap and Mysterio is from another Earth. That's going to be the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is just like, it feels like, because at the end of our Endgame podcast, we had a lot of questions about, well, then what does this mean for Spider-Man Far From Home? Because, like, they feel like they've said it takes place after it and all this stuff. And then, yeah, and then immediately, like, the first thing in this trailer is like, fuck it, Tony Stark is dead. And it's like, well, shit. And it's like, okay, yeah, no, that's cool. Like, it's nice because it immediately gives this movie, like, way more of an identity than it seemed like it had from that first trailer, where it was like Spider-Man goes to Europe and there has adventures and Mysterio will be a cool villain, but there wasn't just much to there wasn't much to read off of that first trailer. This one, it much more pitches, okay, this is where Peter Parker is as a character, and so this will give him an arc for this movie of him having to get over the death of Tony and him being weirdly displaced. And I'm still very curious how much they will lean into the you were fucking dead for 5 years and came back side of it, because clearly they're going to lean into the Tony Stark's dead side of it, which is an easier nut to crack.
I think you just make jokes about it. Like, you have to have the scene where the entire, like, math club is sitting around being like, what were the odds that we all got snapped and none of our classmates? And then, like, they... Because they're all, like, math, you know, math geniuses. Like, they all have to... They're at a STEM school. That would be a great joke. They should do that.
Yeah. And then, you know, he goes home and he is, like, he fucking buys a PlayStation 5 or some shit. Just, like, one thing I feel like where we haven't grappled with now and that... maybe they have not fully grappled with is that now the Marvel movies are set 5 years in the future because they were always contemporary. And so now it's 5 years off. So I would love it if there's just some weird fucking like weird new, like video game console or like car or something. It's like a new technology that was invented in the intervening 5 years. It's like nobody's using smartphones anymore because we just have like neural implants. So it's like, what are you doing with that fucking iPhone? Apple dissolved in the 5 years since Thanos died. Like, what the fuck are you doing, Pete?
You know what they should have done for Spider-Man? Is had, you know how they made a really big deal out of how like they had a properly aged Aunt May for the first time with Marissa Tomei? Just recast her, have her be old Aunt May now, and make a joke, like, in those 5 years, like, she really aged a lot, and now
have, like, losing all, like, she have been a lot of stress.
Yes.
That's a long 5 fucking years, man.
I think Rosemary Harris is still alive. Have her come back and play Aunt May. It would be so funny.
Yeah. There's a lot of material you could definitely go through. I'm assuming that they probably just had Aunt May dead for those 5 years.
Yeah, we'll see.
I don't know. We'll see.
Because, again, the scars of that would be so immense.
Yeah. Like, any character that survived that snap would be, like, just completely changed in the intervening 5 years. You can't just, like, come back and be like, oh, hey, Pete. It's like, you need to address it if she had been alive.
Yeah. Like, what did she do with Peter's bedroom?
There's just so much shit. So I'm curious how much of that the movie leans into. But to going back to what they show in the trailer, one of the things I'm now most excited for is seeing what they're going to do with Mysterio. Like, is he legitimately from a parallel universe, or is he using that as a way to get in good with S.H.I.E.L.D. to do some fucking fucked up Mysterio shit? Because for people who don't know that much about Mysterio, his original origin story is he's just like a famous stuntman from Hollywood who turned to crime and used all of his knowledge of like practical special effects and stunt work to like trick the public. And like one of the first things he does is he impersonates Spider-Man and does a bunch of heists of Spider-Man and then appears as Mysterio and is like, oh, I, Mysterio, I will save us from the Spider-Menace and defeat Spider-Man. And we'll get even, his plans like to get even more money from capturing Spider-Man, getting like rewards and shit. So that's kind of his whole thing, is he's this like super sophisticated con man who uses his incredible knowledge of like practical effects and everything to get one over on people and use illusions and shit. So I'm curious to see what their take is on Mysterio, because you could do it, because I think you could play it straight and just have like, no, this is just a fucking weird dude from another universe, or you could just like do like mind chess crazy Mysterio shit with it.
I want them to do that.
Yeah.
I think it feels to me like the twist is going to be pretty obvious, where like in the trailer they set up that S.H.I.E.L.D. is working with Mysterio to take down these like weird elemental forces. These monsters. My guess is Mysterio is manipulating all of that. There'll be a big second act twist, and then they'll have to like take him down. Because everyone's talking about like, oh, they're introducing the multiverse into the MCU. And my whole thing is like, maybe, but if they were going to do it, I don't think they reveal it in a one-liner from Sam Jackson in the trailer for Spider-Man.
My guess is that it's going to be like, oh, Mysterio has like done all this shit and like created these, whether they're illusions or whatever he's done, to create the problem that then he shows up to solve, because that is the classic Mysterio story. In the same way that like every Lizard story boils down to some version of lizards trying to turn all the people in the world into lizard monsters, every Mysterio story somehow boils down to he has created some sort of problem that is not really a problem, so that people will get him to solve it, and he'll get some reward from that in some way. So I'm guessing that that's going to be what it is, and it's going to be like, no, you fools, I can't believe you believed in all that multiverse shit. And then at the very end of the movie, something will be like, oh no, there really is some multiverse shit. Because that would be a good thing to reveal, to sort of pivot into another phase, because I feel like after you do all the Infinity Gems and Thanos, you need something to like change the scale and like give us another focus if they want to keep on doing these movies till the end of time, which based on another item we'll talk about in news later is where we're going. You need now to shift into a bigger, like new overarching plan, since we don't have Thanos and the Infinity shit anymore. So dealing with multiple universe stuff would give you a lot of room, and you can introduce characters like Kang the Conqueror and that kind of stuff, and open it up that way.
I think Avengers 5 should be a Universe 6 versus Universe 7 tournament. With all the Avengers from Universe 6 versus all the Avengers from... Just assuming they use because they use the Dragon Ball time travel logic in Avengers Endgame. I want them to use the Dragon Ball universe logic in their multiverse stuff.
Oh, that would be very good. But also, if they do multiverse stuff, that would be a really natural way for them to bring in the Fantastic Four. Because in Ultimate Fantastic Four... they change a lot of, like, the we're going into space and that gives us superpowers too. We're going into another dimension and that gives us superpowers. And maybe they're, like, the Fantastic Four in the MCU is from another universe that they, like, broke through into ours. And in so doing, gained these weird fucked up powers. Like, there's a lot of space you could use that multiverse stuff for.
And if they ever want to do X-Men, now you have a way to do X-Men.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
This trailer made me a lot more interested. Like, obviously, I was interested in the movie because it's a Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
But it gives this movie much more of a sense of identity. And it seems like a cool way to close off this phase of Marvel films by having this be, like, both its own movie and then also the sort of, like, epilogue to Avengers Endgame and deal with, like, the fallout of that movie on Peter, who, of all the characters in the MCU, their version of Peter Parker, I think, is the most appropriate character to sort of carry that sort of the grief through to its natural conclusion.
Yeah. And also, I should just say, like, revealing that one of the reasons Peter is going to Europe is that he's dealing with the death of Tony Stark feels much more natural to that character than a story where Peter's like, fuck it, I'm going to Europe for a summer.
Exactly.
I do not think Peter Parker would just do that of his own volition, you know?
Yeah, it definitely makes all the stuff of them going to somewhere else make a lot more sense.
Yeah. All right, continuing our comic book news block, HBO is soon going to be in deep fucking trouble because Game of Thrones is ending.
Yes.
No, I
don't. And if they're going to be in deep fucking trouble because Game of Thrones is ending, it seems like everybody hates it.
Yeah, well, that too. But HBO will actually be fine. And one of the reasons they'll probably be fine is that they have multiple big shows coming later this year. One of them is His Dark Materials. The
Phil Pullman young adult novel series. Yeah.
Which there was a trailer for that. Looks definitely better than the Golden Compass movie that was made about 10 years ago. But the other one, of course, is Watchmen. We have been following this for a while. HBO is doing a Watchmen TV series. It is created by and showrun by Damon Lindelof, who did Lost and The Leftovers for HBO. And it stars Regina King, Jeremy Irons, a bunch of other actors. It's going to be directed by a woman named Nicole Cassell, who did a bunch of The Leftovers. She's a fantastic director. But we had not really seen anything of it. They finally put out a teaser. It's been playing on, like, Game of Thrones episodes and everything. It's about a minute and a half long. I think it's a really interesting teaser in terms of, like, it showing the visual direction they're going in, how they're incorporating some of the lore. I still don't really know what the story is going to be, but it does look like they're very much making clear on their promise that Damon Lindelof made of, like, this is not an adaptation of Watchmen, it's a story in a world where Watchmen happened.
Yeah.
And I find that very interesting, and I will say, if nothing else, this is a kind of as constructed, just a dynamite little 90 seconds of footage. Even if I knew nothing about Watchmen, it's pretty well put together.
Yeah, it definitely made me more interested in the project than I was before, just because, you know, I haven't seen The Leftovers, so I didn't have the, like, buy-in that you already had. But yeah, it's a really cool looking trailer. I like all the shit with, like, the weird Rorschach people in the church and all that stuff. Like, it looks like they have a good handle on let's go in, like, a very unique, different direction with it than just, like, when it first sounded like HBO was making a Watchmen series, like, they might immediately went to the dumbest possible things. This looks like it is not the dumbest possible thing.
Because,
nice.
Yeah, like, the Rorschach cult is one of those things that I think is, it's in the trailer on purpose. Because if you go back to the Zack Snyder movie, one of the things Zack Snyder gets wrong, like, Jackie Earle Haley is great as Rorschach in that movie. And, like, the visual design of Rorschach in that movie is great. But I do not think that movie fully understands what Alan Moore was saying about Rorschach.
Exactly, yeah.
Like, it positions Rorschach as kind of an unironic hero by the end of that movie. Whereas Alan Moore is like, you know, he's not the worst person ever, but he is kind of a fascist douchebag, you know? And, like, Damon Lindelof's show, the teaser starts with, this dude inspired a violent cult. Like, yeah, no, that feels right. I think Damon Lindelof probably understands this book.
Yeah, and it makes me really curious how they're going to deal with, like, filling in that backstory for people who are not necessarily, like, intimately familiar with the details of Watchmen and, is their version of it going to be, like, their version of what the events of Watchmen were? Are they going to be slightly different? Like, are we going, like, is there going to be direct references to giant alien squid monster that blew up Manhattan? Or is it going to be something else, like faking Dr. Manhattan having done it, like the movie version? I'm curious to see, because I feel like that's a big thing that this has to tackle, because you can't just assume that everybody watching this has knows everything about what Watchmen was.
Yeah. One cool detail, this is sort of confirmed in the trailer, but we've also heard it in news reports, is that Jeremy Irons is playing an old Adrian Veidt, Ozymandias.
Yeah.
Which, one, ah man, that's a great fucking idea to like follow this dude to old age and have him be played by Jeremy Irons.
Yeah.
That's a really good idea. You know, a lot of the other characters are just original characters, new to, like, Regina King is playing a cop, and it seems like there's going to be some, like the trailer seems like it's a time where, like, superheroes or comic book heroes are, like, trying to make an uprising again.
Yeah.
And I think it looks interesting. I will admit, after Lost, and especially The Leftovers, I have infinite buy-in on whatever Damon Lindelof wants to do for life. I will watch it enthusiastically. But this feels like, okay, terrible idea at the outset. HBO's Watchmen, we don't need that. And then it's just like, if you put enough talented people in a room, even a bad idea can become a good one.
Yeah.
I am very interested in this. And Sean, we are going to need to do a Watchmen episode over the summer.
Okay, yeah, yeah, for the graphic novel and everything.
The graphic novel, yeah. I think we should rewatch the Snyder movie at some point. Because it's been 10 years. This is the 10th anniversary of the Snyder film. And I would kind of like, because I haven't watched it in years.
Yeah, I saw it once after, because I think I'm pretty sure I have it on DVD, so
yeah.
I must have watched it once after it came out.
Yeah, in the theaters. It would have been like the director's cut they did. And I would like to just like, especially like with comic books having changed, or comic book movies having changed so much since then, Zack Snyder's career having changed so much since then, I think it would be interesting to watch that movie and talk about it, but also just read the graphic novel and talk about it.
Yeah.
This should be an episode.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that, but 100%. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I should say, I have a story about this.
Okay.
So when this trailer came out and I was thinking that we should do this episode, I was like, I want to read Watchmen again. I have not read that book in years. Probably since undergrad, you know? And I was like, I know I have the book somewhere, but I have moved 2 times in the last year.
Yeah.
It becomes hard to find your books. So I even went into my little storage area. I'm looking through my boxes. I can't find it. And I was back in Iowa at this point, and I thought, yeah, it must be at my parents' house or something. But I kind of wanted to read it now, so I'm like... And then when I went to see Detective Pikachu, that theater is right next door to a Barnes & Noble. So I'm like, okay, well, let me go into Barnes & Noble and see if they have Watchmen. And they did, and I had a coupon, and I'm like, okay, this is great. I got it for like $15. And I'm like, this is great. And then I go home after Detective Pikachu, I sit down in my living room, and I open Watchmen, and I'm looking at it, I'm like, oh man, I love it. I know where the book is. I just immediately, like, opening the book, I'm like... And I went back, and I knew the exact box it was in. And it was just like, I needed to like hold the physical material.
Uh-huh.
And then I remembered. So I went and returned the book later. Because I didn't need 2 copies of it. But it was just like, I hate when that happens.
Uh-huh.
Where I was just like, I have no idea where this is. $15 isn't much. I can buy another copy. Ah, oh, fuck. Now yeah. I know where it is.
I got very close to doing that with a copy of Frankenstein like 2 or 3 years ago. Because it was the copy I had read during my undergrad when we did Frankenstein for one of my classes. Like, I want to read Frankenstein again. That's one of my favorite books. It's like, when I went through all my boxes where all my college books were, I was like, it's not in any of these boxes. And then I was like about to go, I was like, oh, fuck it, I'm just going to order it. And then I immediately was like, oh shit, right, it's in like this part of my closet because I had brought it home after that class and had not had it up in the condo when we put it away. So yeah, I get that feeling.
Yeah, it's the moving twice in 1 year is so fucking disorienting. If you don't like, because there's some things that I know where they are because I've taken them out and arranged them. But, you know, I haven't done it with everything. And then it's just, I don't know where half my shit is now. But that's how it goes. All right. Finishing off our movie news. Disney, about 2 weeks ago, put out a release calendar. This was part of an investor, like, shareholder call, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they were showing, like, here are our planned release dates through the year 2027. So they announced 63 release dates through 2027.
Which is like almost a decade.
Almost a decade.
It's such a long time.
Most of these do not have titles or anything yet. It's just like untitled Marvel movie, untitled Star Wars movie, all of that. But let's go through what we've got here out of these 63 release dates. So Marvel movies, they are doing May and November 2020. So next year we're getting two. So we've slowed down a little bit. This year was 3 with Captain Marvel, Avengers, and then Spider-Man. Next year will just be 2. But then they're going back to 3. 2021 will be February, May, November. I'm guessing one of those is Black Panther. And then 2022 is February, May, July. We're going to hear more about this later in the summer, Kevin Feige said, about what movies they're making. I think it is kind of fascinating. After Spider-Man, we don't know what any of these movies are.
Yeah, it's really exciting to, you know, not know what characters are getting, like, which ones are getting sequels. Obviously, we know, like, there's going to be another Black Panther. There's obviously going to be another Guardians, eventually with James Gunn. But yeah, I'm curious to see what are the new characters they're going to bring on board.
Because my guess is 2020, one of those will be the Black Widow movie, because that's shooting already. 2021, I think, will be Black Panther 2. Like, I think they probably just do February again, because why break a good thing? That movie made so much money.
Uh-huh.
And then 2022, one of those will be Guardians 2. But past that, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, really fascinating. Star Wars will not be coming back until 2022. So, we've got...
Thank God.
We've got Rise of Skywalker this year, and then it will be December 2022, 2024, and 2026. So, 3 more movies. And we can talk about this later. They've already announced the 2022 one is the Benioff and Weiss movie.
Yes.
From the Game of Thrones people. We also know Avatar 2, Avatar 3, Avatar 4, and Avatar 5 will be coming out on the off years. So December 2021, 2023, 2025, and 2027 will be Avatar 2, 3, 4, and 5, which means we will have alternating Decembers from the year 2021 through 2027 of either Star Wars or Avatar in theaters.
Fucking shit.
It's, you know what? At the very least, it is smarter than trying to do a Star Wars movie once a year.
Yes, yeah. At least they're like... Because, and it's like the one thing that was nice about seeing this was like a... Okay, they are serious about slowing down on the Star Wars shit after Solo basically bombed. Because they had said that like, oh, we're reconsidering what we're doing, but it didn't feel like anything was set in stone. And this is more like, okay, good. Because I physically would not be able to fucking handle it anymore if we had to do a Star Wars movie every year on this podcast. Like, I just could, I don't have it in me. Like, it hurts me to have to be, like, down on Star Wars as frequently as I have been. And so it's like, if I can just get a couple of years off from that, and then maybe they can put out, you know, something that's just, can be just, like, good on its own without having, because the one thing, good thing we got was The Last Jedi, but even that was, like, frustratingly kind of handicapped by how bad I thought Force Awakens was. And so, yeah, like, just getting away from it for a little bit will be very nice for me in my heart.
The Avatar thing, because part of why they did this calendar was they're showing how they're incorporating all their Fox assets now. Because Avatar was a Fox movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, James Cameron has been planning these Avatar sequels for fucking ever. At first it was just going to be Avatar 2, then it was Avatar 2 and 3, then 2, 3, 4, then 2, 3, 4, 5. Avatar 2 was originally scheduled for 2016. It has been delayed so many times. And now they've just settled on, we're going to do these alternating years starting in 2021. I think Avatar 2 and 3 have already finished principal photography, for whatever that matters, for all CGI movies. But yeah, I just... Boy, that's a lot of confidence in Avatar. I know Avatar is the highest grossing movie of all time, but it is such a weird outlier. It's just, man.
It's been so long. It's been so fun. When did that movie come out? Like 2008?
2009.
2009.
So this is the 10th anniversary, which means it will be 12 years from Avatar 1 to 2. And you're really banking on people wanting 4 Avatar movies. Because what if Avatar 2, like, underperforms?
Uh-huh, yeah.
What, you're stuck at that point, because you've got 3, 4, and 5 in the pipeline. Like, Star Wars will always do well. I don't know if it'll always be the highest grossing movie of the year, but it'll always do well. I just don't know about Avatar. I mean, I don't ever really want to bet against James Cameron, because history does not reward that, but who the hell knows?
But, you know, history doesn't reward that until it does. You know? Yeah. That's like, you know, there's only so many times you can bet on black and it will pay off for you, right? Eventually, you know, something will land red.
You play Russian roulette, you can play it 5 times in a row maximum.
Exactly. It's a darker version of the metaphor, yeah.
Yes.
I was just going for normal roulette.
Okay. We also have Indiana Jones 5. Is planned for July 2021.
Something I had completely forgotten was like something that had been like that far along that someone would put a date on it.
Yeah, because they also announced in here, I didn't have it on there, but Steven Spielberg's next movie before he jumps on to making Indiana Jones is West Side Story. He's doing a remake of that.
Yeah.
And I think they've got that planned for 2020, and then he would do Indiana Jones after that. Let's just play the game, how old will Harrison Ford be in 2021? He is 76. He will turn 77 this July, which means he will be 79 years old when Indiana Jones 5 comes out. Please don't kill Harrison Ford, Disney.
For the love of God. Like, I just don't get it. I mean, you know, we are among the most positive people you could find on Indiana Jones 4, and we don't like it that much.
No.
It's like most people despise that fucking movie. I just don't know who thinks it's such a good idea to make another Indiana Jones movie, especially with Harrison Ford at this point. Like, if you want to do like an Indiana Jones reboot, I would be annoyed about it and people get angry at you on the internet for that idea. But I could imagine that being a decent movie.
Honestly, if they were to do it, get Alden Ehrenreich, who played Solo. I actually think he would be even better as Indiana Jones.
I agree, yeah.
And that would honestly probably be a pretty good movie. Like, because what I want out of Steven Spielberg is another Tintin movie or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like, I want a new adventure movie. You know what they should do for the plot of this one? Indiana Jones runs for president. Current Democratic field? That's as old as Joe Biden is? That's as old as Bernie Sanders? I think he'd be perfect for it. Indy runs for president.
What I want from this is just, you know, because in Indiana Jones 4, it was all the alien stuff. I want, like, 10 minutes into this movie, Indiana Jones gets teleported into space, and he's just in space for the rest of the movie. He just becomes Han Solo. Like, just, like, I just don't need another Indiana Jones movie. And, any idea I have for it is just, like, make it very dumb, and then maybe I'll be interested. But I can't imagine a Indiana Jones 5 with a 79-year-old Harrison Ford, and you play that movie straight. I can't imagine that being even okay, right?
No. All right, Disney also announced that New Mutants, the X-Men movie that will never come out, got another new release date. It's been pushed back again now to April 2020, which is a full 2 years from its original date of April 2018. The movie was supposed to have extensive reshoots. Those still have not happened. It's unclear if they ever will or if Disney is just putting out the movie that was made. We don't know at this point. But they are. That is a surprise. I think everyone thought that was just going to go to Disney Plus, but they're giving it a theatrical release.
Yeah.
So, and that is the last of the Fox X-Men movies. Interesting to note, though, there were no other X-Men movies, no more Deadpool movies on the calendar, none of that.
Oh, I hadn't thought about Deadpool, because, like, I would not expect them to be making more X-Men movies in the line of X-Men movies, but
Deadpool's huge. Like,
yeah, Deadpool makes so much, it would be weird for them not to do another Deadpool.
I'd also be bummed, because Deadpool 2 was really good.
Yeah.
I just, and at this point, I kind of love Ryan Reynolds, especially after, like, Detective Pikachu and everything.
Yeah, I mean, you need to at least make one more Deadpool, because you need to have all the fucking Detective Pikachu jokes in it, right?
Yeah.
It's like, that needs to happen.
And I want Deadpool 3, because I think they would open it with the fucking Disney logo. They would have to do it. Like, it would be Deadpool doing the Disney logo. It would be fun. But yeah, there were a few other known Fox properties in the works, like Kingsman 3 is coming out next year, Avatar, obviously, but nothing else from Fox, and they actually made it clear, the head of Disney said, you know, Fox used to put out like 12 to 15 big movies a year, we're going to cut that down to like 5 to 6, so again, Disney was not buying Fox to use their IPs. They were buying Fox to get rid of the competition.
Yeah.
And Fox happened to have 7 Avatar movies in the works. And they're like, we'll put out some Avatar movies.
Sure.
Why not?
Yeah.
In for a penny, in for a fucking pound. But yeah, Jesus Christ. That document, Disney's calendar, should just be Exhibit A in the antitrust case. Right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Like, oh my God.
It was a pretty horrifying thing to just have out there and just look at it, it's like, oh, what the fuck? And it is the Untitled Marvel's Project, Avatar 3, Untitled Star Wars. It's just like,
we didn't even get into all the Untitled Disney live action film.
Oh, right, that was the other part. I remember that because I felt like there's something else that was all over that. There's like a dozen of those. It's like, I feel like there's more of those than they could make. Like, because Disney doesn't have original ideas that they can make fucking original movies.
They're not original, they're remakes, Sean.
Exactly. So it's like, but they also don't have that many classic movies. Like, are we going to get a second fucking remake of Beauty and the Beast? Like, how? It just seemed like there was more than you could possibly do. Like, Sean, they're going to end up doing a live action remake of fucking The Princess and the Frog, a movie that's only like 10 years old.
Yes. So they also had Disney Animation and Pixar on there, but that's understandable. The Untitled Disney live actions are terrifying to me because you're right. I think what we're going to have to do is lap them, and we're going to have to do Beauty and the Beast 2, Belle's Magical Christmas, the remake. We're going to have to do Lion King 2, Simba's Pride, the remake. Like, we're going to be remaking direct-to-video sequels really soon. Sean, did you even know, they also showed this at their investor presentation, that there is a live-action Lady and the Tramp that has already been made and is coming to, it is a Disney Plus original launching on launch day of Disney Plus this November.
The fuck is a live-action Lady and the, both the characters are fucking dogs! And I mean, they're making a live-action, quote-unquote, live-action Lion King movie, so I don't even know what I'm talking about. Like, of course it's a live-action movie.
Yeah,
I'm an idiot.
And it's real dogs. It's like they're doing it Homeward Bound style with like
fucking peanut butter in their mouth.
It's Tessa Thompson voicing Lady.
What?
It's Justin Theroux as Tramp. Which one? I know they're voicing dogs, but the age difference between Tessa Thompson and Justin Theroux is weird there. Sam Elliott is playing Trusty the Bloodhound.
Okay. Benedict, I like that.
Benedict Wong is Bull the Bulldog. I like that. And Janelle Monáe is Peg, the Pekingese. That's funny. But yeah, like, it's very weird. They're making it. It's coming out November 12th, 2019. They've already made it. You can see a picture here, Sean, of the dogs.
Yeah.
But yeah.
It's a Lady and a Tramp, all right.
And no one knew. That means they have four of these this year, Sean. Dumbo, Aladdin, Lion King, and Lady and the Tramp. They're going to run out of these real fucking quick.
I'm really looking forward to the fucking live-action remake of Steamboat Willie that we're eventually going to get.
2-hour gritty reboot.
Yeah. Jesus Christ, Disney. What? God. It's too much, Jonathan. It's just too much.
I know. All right. So, Sean, you want to do some video game news?
Sure, yeah. Let's keep going.
So let's start with, this is a report from Kotaku that just posted. We're recording this Saturday, the 18th. This just posted at like 2 p.m. right before we started. And Jason Schreier is reporting that next year's Call of Duty has gone through a major upheaval. So this is not this year's, the 2019 game. We still don't officially know what that is, but he says here, and we've heard this elsewhere, that this year's game is a Modern Warfare sequel,
yeah,
or reboot.
Basically Modern Warfare 4 or something.
Yeah, it's Infinity Ward's turn, and so it will be probably be a Modern Warfare game. But this is about 2020, so next in line would have been Sledgehammer.
Yeah, who they made Call of Duty Advanced Warfare, a game I like quite a bit. Then they made Call of Duty World War II, which was last year's game.
Yes.
So wait, no. It was two years ago.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, because last year's game was Black Ops 4. So it would be their turn after Treyarch, Infinity Ward, and then them.
Yeah, so it was going to be Sledgehammer, and they had also assigned a studio called Raven to work with Sledgehammer. It was going to be a Cold War game involving Vietnam. But now, Treyarch, who usually would be going, they just went last year, so it would take a while. They would be going in 2021. Treyarch has been put in charge of the game. It is switching to be Black Ops 5. So Sledgehammer's cycle, spot in the cycle, is kind of just getting skipped. Black Ops 5, which I assume will be spelled 11111, will be coming out 2020. So let me just read here from the report. According to those briefed on the overhaul, Treyarch will take creative leadership on this new Black Ops, while Raven and Sledgehammer will serve as support for the game, transforming the work they've done on their own single-player story mode into a campaign for Black Ops 5, which will also be set during the Cold War. It will likely be a cross-gen game to coincide with the launch of the next PlayStation and Xbox, which are expected in the fall of 2020.
Which, you know, there's nothing puts more confidence in a video game than you put another developer as, like, in, now put them as the lead in front of that video game, which then effectively cuts the development of time of that game down by 33%. And that same game is also going to be a cross-gen game that's going to come out on the new consoles and this one. Like, we all know how great Call of Duty Ghosts was, and that one was had a full development cycle. It didn't even have this abbreviated one of it. So, of course, this is going to be, obviously, a great choice.
Yes. So let's also talk about... So all of this so far, though, other than, like, the timeline stuff you're talking about, makes sense if you have to reboot it. Black Ops is the proven brand.
Yeah, I mean, Black Ops 1 already was the Cold War game that had a bunch of Vietnam stuff in it. So yeah, if you're making another Cold War one, I guess might as well brand it as a Black Ops game.
And it sounds like what they're doing is, like, Treyarch... It sounds like a lot of people at... So what Jason reports here is that some people at Treyarch are a little frustrated at the time crunch they're going to have. Others are saying, like... But we did a really good job on Black Ops 4. We've got a really good foundation. What Treyarch is mostly working on is the multiplayer, because they're taking pieces from the Sledgehammer campaign and just building a new campaign out of it. So it sounds like it could work. Where this gets really interesting is here. So it says, This news comes during a strange time for Activision and Call of Duty. Although Black Ops 4 sold well at first, we've heard that it hasn't had quite the revenue tail that Activision's bean counters were hoping to see. Internally, Activision executives have started to talk about embracing free-to-play as a revenue model, once anathema to the publisher, and three sources say are looking into offering a free-to-play component for this year's new Modern Warfare, although the specifics may not be finalized yet. So, a lot could be changing on Call of Duty. You and I have been talking about this for a while. Like, yep. When do they just go full Apex Legends free-to-play? It could be as soon as this year for parts of it. I mean, it would make sense. Like, Call of Duty games are already so bifurcated into pieces.
Yeah.
It would make sense to just start selling them as, like, $20 for the campaign, $40 for campaign and multiplayer, $60 for campaign, multiplayer, and season pass or something.
And zombies.
And zombies, yeah. I forgot about it. There's so many pieces. But, yeah, this is weird because they've been on that like three studios, 3 years schedule for this entire generation and most of last gen, and it's worked totally fine. There's been good games and bad games, but it's worked. So this is a big piece of news for Call of Duty and a big question as Call of Duty heads into its fourth generation, I guess.
Yeah, and it like one thing that it sort of feels like is, like, on the outside looking in, it feels like Activision never really treated Sledgehammer at the same level as Treyarch in Infinity Ward. Because, like, going from, oh, we're doing Advanced Warfare 2, now we're doing Call of Duty World War 2, you know, they were never given the opportunity to create a brand for themselves the way that Infinity Ward had Modern Warfare and Treyarch had Black Ops. And so it's especially someone who really liked Advanced Warfare, even though I know that game was not as beloved by the Call of Duty community. Like, one of the reasons why I liked it was because it had weird shit in it that kind of broke the game competitively but made it a lot more fun to play as someone who doesn't give a shit about competitive Call of Duty. And it feels like Activision had an opportunity to have a thing where it's like, you know, not every Call of Duty game has to be for every Call of Duty player, potentially. It is like, if, you know, Sledgehammer had put out an iteration on Advanced Warfare 2, I would have jumped all over that fucking game. And that's not the opportunity that studio got to have. And then for their third game, they kind of got, like, in this weird situation where Raven Software, which is, like, a good old studio that basically got gutted by Activision and put onto Call of Duty DLC, then they put them, like, in as, like, a, like they're kind of, like, we're co-directing, these two studios co-directing this project. Sounds like that did not work out. And now, like, this game sounds like it's probably going to be a fucking disaster as far as Call of Duty games go. Because I can't imagine this scenario producing a really good Call of Duty game, especially if it has to be cross-gen on top of everything else.
I mean,
That means they're developing it for, like, five fucking platforms.
And Treyarch has been easily their most reliable developer. Because the Treyarch games come out on time, they always do very well, and they are always critically well-received. That has been the case. The only one that wasn't true for was World at War, you know,
which
was
their Call first of Duty game. 3, then World at War.
I forgot they did Call of Duty 3.
Yeah, so everybody did, because Call of Duty 3 was not very good.
No, so rocky start, but, like, they have for two generations now been the bedrock. Like, we think Infinity Ward made the best one, Infinite Warfare, but they also did Ghosts, like, you know. So they've had up and down. Treyarch has been kind of rock solid. Now they're on this, what sounds like a suicide mission, you know? And it's like, I guess if you have to do a suicide mission, put your best team on it. But at the same time, like, I don't want to go on a suicide mission.
Yeah. So, and then it raises questions for then, like, how does that impact then Treyarch's subsequent game? And, like, are they, like, totally abandoning the three studio thing at this point? I'm interested to see, like, how this transition into a new generation will potentially affect some of these really long-running franchises like Call of Duty, which Call of Duty has now spanned two full generations of consoles.
Yeah.
Like, how does it try to manage to continue, like, going on for a full third?
Because if we're thinking about annualized franchises, like, Assassin's Creed is just taking a break, I assume, until the next generation.
Yeah, presumably.
Like, so that they have plenty of time to, because I assume the next Assassin's Creed will be cross-gen, but they will have had years to prepare for that, not, hey, it is May of 2019. Get this ready for October 2020. You cool with that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, for two systems, we don't know what they are yet. Go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's scary. So, yeah, we'll see where that goes. But more video game news.
Okay, yeah.
PlayStation had their
State of Play.
State of Play. I'm sorry. Everyone has their own fucking thing at this point. And all I remember is Nintendo Direct. Because that's the easy one.
Yeah, they've been doing it for like 8 years or something.
But at State of Play, PlayStation showed off a new trailer for the Final Fantasy VII Remake, which we all thought was either dead or lost in the woods. It has found its way out of the woods. It exists. We still don't quite know in what form, but it does exist. There was a little two-minute trailer, and they said more in June. We assume that's E3. Square Enix has their own E3 event again. At least they'll have something to show this time.
You know, they had plenty that they could have possibly shown at their last one. They chose not to, so I would make no bets.
But, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of talk about it, and frankly, I watched the remake trailer, and it was just like, yeah, that's kind of what we saw last time. It's still all from, like, the first hour of the game. It's all the early stuff on the train.
I mean, I'm assuming they didn't talk about it again, but I'm assuming the game is still episodic, and so it makes sense for them to show stuff from that's early on, because it's going to be the episode one of Final Fantasy Remake, so...
I don't know. I have not heard this opinion a lot, but my general opinion is just Final Fantasy VII is fine the way it is, and if you're going to put all this money and effort into it, make a new game, but...
Yeah, I mean, seeing this trailer reminded me that I have no particular affection for... Like, I think Final Fantasy VII is fine. I've never played it to completion. I've never gotten particularly close to finishing it, but, like, I like Final Fantasy VII okay, but I certainly have no real nostalgia for it. Nor do I have a strong affection to that Final Fantasy specifically, or for most Final Fantasy in general. So it made me realize, like, right, I've only been curious about this as a curiosity, not as something for me. So it just sort of, like, re-cemented my, like, general apathy about the concept of a remade Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah, I don't... Because the other thing to me is that it's a totally different battle system. It's all, like... It's more like Final Fantasy XV.
Yeah, it looked almost like a little bit Kingdom Heartsy to me.
Yeah.
Like that sort of action RPG
and
thing
I don't
they've been doing.
I really like the battle system in Final Fantasy VII. I like the turn-based stuff. That's the game to me, so I don't...
Honestly, that's something that makes me a little bit more... Like, if it was just the turn-based battle stuff, I would 100% just be... Then just I would just play the old Final Fantasy VII. Like,
okay.
Put a new battle system in there. At least that gives this game at least some of its own identity beyond a visual upgrade.
I'm very curious what it's going to turn out to be. I think this could wind up being kind of like a... The remake of Evangelion situation, where it's Hideaki Anno is doing that 4-part theatrical remake that started like 10 years ago, and they made movie 1, then they got movie 2 out pretty fast, then it took like 5 years for movie 3, and now it's been almost a decade for movie 4, and I feel like that's probably what's going to happen with Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah, if episode 1 ever even truly comes out, even if they showed this trailer, I'm still not convinced. We'll see what Square Enix has to show at E3, if anything.
I do technically have this game pre-ordered because when Amazon was cutting off their 20% discount, I just pre-ordered a bunch of stuff because I can cancel whenever and there's no penalty. And that was one of the ones I grabbed kind of on a laugh because it's still just a blank box that says Final Fantasy VII Remake on it. Do you think they really put this out and that's just the name, Final Fantasy VII Remake?
Like, I would normally say no, but I feel like... I mean, I guess we'll see if at this E3, if they have not rebranded it, then, like, yes, I'm going to say it's going to be Final Fantasy VII R or Final Fantasy VII Remake.
Here's what it's going to be, Sean. It's going to be Final Fantasy VII, lowercase re, colon, capital, make.
Sure.
Right? Kind of like recode or whatever they did with Kingdom Hearts. Yeah.
You know, that's a possibility. It's, you know... You can do whatever you want. I want them to have it done dumb, like Final Fantasy VII Reloaded or something. I want a dumb subtitle on it. That would make me happy.
All right. Nintendo had a Direct this week where they showed off Super Mario Maker 2. That's coming out June 28th. They showed off a bunch of new features. I'm quoting from Kotaku's story on this, including slopes, on-off switches, seesaws, angry suns, and even mechanics that have never been in Mario before, like swinging claws and a dry bones shell that lets you glide in lava and hide as a pile of bones. You can add auto-scroll to your levels, swap themes, insert moving water or lava, and much, much more. They also added, this is me now, night mode. I really like that. It's this mode where, like, there's different physics and stuff depending on what skin you're on, like original Mario, Mario 3. There's also a story mode in this game with 100-plus levels made in Mario Maker but by Nintendo's engineers that has you rebuilding Princess Peach's castle by playing these levels. It has cooperative and competitive multiplayer modes for up to 4 players, and while they did not announce this, gameplay in the trailer shows that some of that is even couch co-op with one screen. And there is the Super Mario 3D World mode. It is separate from the other 4 because it has unique features different than the other skins, like advanced physics, including stuff like glass pipes, all the catsuit stuff, etc. I gotta tell you, Sean, with everything they are putting in this game, this looks like a serious fucking Game of the Year contender to me.
Yeah, no, like, it's a lot more expansive than I expected a Super Mario Maker 2 to be. Like, yeah. I mostly expected it to be sort of what Splatoon 2 was of, like, a, oh, we brought, like, this, like, the core game over to the Switch, and we added a bunch of stuff on top of it, but not, like, enough for it to feel like a totally new thing. This feels like what they showed of this makes Super Mario Maker 1 look like a proof of concept, and this looks like real Super Mario Maker at some point.
And Mario Maker 1 was great.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Everyone loved it. I don't think anyone was complaining about, like, I mean, there were things people wanted in it, but it was kind of like complaining about it felt ungrateful.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, we couldn't make Mario games before. But yeah, like, it's nuts how much is in there. It's crazy how good the control scheme looks, because they have to do it all on a controller now.
Yeah, so they have all, like, these radial menus and stuff.
Yeah, like, man, I like Mario Maker 1, but I never got that into it. I mean it. Like, this, especially because this has been a fairly anemic year for games, and we don't know what's coming the second half of the year, I think this is going to be up there. This looks like one of the cooler things coming this year.
Yeah, no, I was very impressed by how much, like, it looks like they're piloting. And, like, it's coming out so soon.
Yep.
I keep on forgetting, like, because since they haven't talked about it much, it feels like it's a game that's way further off than it is. It's coming out in, like, July or something, right?
June 28th.
Yeah, so it's, yeah. It's, like, right after E3, yeah.
Yep, it's wild. It's, I assume they did this because they're probably not going to talk about it at E3.
Yeah.
We'll probably, I mean, E3 will be Animal Crossing, Pokemon, and... there's probably surprises at that point. Yeah, Link's Awakening, maybe.
Yoshi 2.
Yeah.
Making a sequel to the game we never made, just called Yoshi.
All right. There's a game just called Yoshi. It's the weird puzzle game on NES.
Well, there you go. This is a sequel to that. Yoshi 2.
I think that is an underrated puzzle game, so I'd be into it. But yes, I'm excited for this game. We will be doing that. We'll be talking about that, obviously, on the podcast. And I remember when Mario Maker 1 came out, I shared some of my levels. I will have to get back into that and get you guys some levels for that. They also announced this week Nintendo... So the Mario Maker stuff, awesome and cool. This, weird and confusing. They announced Nintendo Switch Online game vouchers. Did you see this?
No, I don't know what this is.
Okay, this was, like, announced in conjunction with the Mario Maker thing. So this is a new item that if you are a Nintendo Switch Online member, you can buy. You go to Nintendo's website, and it's $99, and they give you two vouchers, which can be used to get a select full-price Nintendo game. So you could get Mario Maker 2 and Breath of the Wild, and you would theoretically be saving $10 on both of those.
Okay.
As you can already tell, it is the most convoluted and confusing way to give Nintendo Switch Online members a $10 discount in the history of $10 discounts.
It sounds like a scam.
Yes,
like,
it does.
Like, even though logically and mathematically what you said, like, you know, would be savings... It sounds like you're somehow scamming people out of their money. I don't know. I don't, like, you immediately, like, I mean, you call anything like this, like, special one-time voucher or, like, something, like, it immediately sounds like you're trying to scam me.
Yeah, because it's not any game. It's all Nintendo first-party stuff. I haven't looked at the full list.
You know.
Yeah, that's fine.
That's, any full-priced game on the Switch is going to be a first-party Nintendo game.
Pretty much. But yeah, so, like, and obviously if you used this for Breath of the Wild and Mario Kart 8, you can get those for cheaper elsewhere. Right?
Yeah, well, those games are used. Like, Nintendo doesn't put their games discount.
Well, not digitally, but it wouldn't even have to be used. Like, Best Buy right now, you can go, like, you can get Pokemon Let's Go for $45.
Okay.
Like, you know, discounts happen on physical.
Yeah, so maybe, like, retail-specific choices.
Yeah. But, so I guess if you're going all digital, you would save money on that. But it is weird. Like, you know, it's something like, I don't know, I might do it if there's Mario Maker 2 and another game coming out digitally later this year I would want to get. But I mostly buy physically on Switch... For a variety of reasons, and it's just weird. Like, why not just give Nintendo Switch Online members a $10 discount? Like,
yeah, it would be like if the PS Plus, instead of, like, you know how PS Plus has, like, a bunch of, like, the little cross next to a game that's like, oh, there's, like, you know, 10% off of this game, and, like, those deals that go in and out. If instead of that, it was if you pay us $100, you'll get, like, you know, this much off on these individual cases. It's like, what?
Yeah.
Why can't it just, like, buy a game for cheaper? Why do I have to give you money for a voucher that I can then spend on a game that would technically cost me less than it would otherwise?
It is just amazing to me that Nintendo is a company that can simultaneously make a game that allows you to build any fucking Mario level imaginable. Which is like, no, we take that for fucking granted now. That's an amazing feat of video game design, right?
Yeah.
That you could just give people the tools to make fucking Mario games, but they also don't know how to put games on sale. Like this is just, that is Nintendo in a fucking nutshell. They are gaming geniuses who are really bad at some basic things.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's a wild ride with Nintendo.
Yep. Speaking of wild rides, Microsoft and Sony vaguely announced this week some sort of cloud gaming partnership. They are partnering on, according to the press release, new cloud-based solutions for gaming experiences. Microsoft, in its press release, said, under the Memorandum of Understanding signed by the parties, the two companies will explore joint development of future cloud solutions in Microsoft Azure to support their respective game and content streaming services. In addition, the two companies will explore the use of current Microsoft Azure data center-based solutions for Sony's game and content streaming services. Kenichiro Yoshida, the president and CEO of Sony, said in the press release, our mission is to seamlessly evolve the PlayStation platform as one that continues to deliver the best and most immersive entertainment experiences together with a cloud environment that ensures the best possible experience anytime, anywhere. For many years, Microsoft has been a key business partner for us, though of course the two companies have also been competing in some areas. I believe that our joint development of future cloud solutions will contribute greatly to the advancement of interactive content.
Yeah, so a couple of things with this is, like, the Memorandum of Understanding does not, like, there's nothing set in stone. This is not right. we're partnering in these very specific ways, and that's, like, active, like, we're acting on it now. It's more like a declaration of intent that at some point in the future, we are looking into options for us to, like, share technology and strategies and data in these specific fields. Because, like, one thing that's, like, one thing I think is interesting is, you know, it was a picture that they, because they, Microsoft put out the press release and with a picture of the president of Sony, the whole company, and the president and CEO of the whole company of Microsoft shaking hands. It was not like Phil Spencer and whoever's heading up like Sony Interactive Entertainment right now. It was not like the PlayStation and Xbox branches. It was the companies like talking about a memorandum of understanding. So like that feels to me like way more abstract and in the distance than we're just immediately using like Azure server stuff for like PS Now or something or anything like that.
Yeah, it's so vague. I don't even want to play the game of what could this be because we don't know. I think based on what you just said and reading between the lines, this probably actually is not built around gaming all that much.
Yeah, it might be like just larger company initiative stuff that that is much bigger than just PlayStation and Xbox.
It could be like Microsoft has server farms and Sony doesn't. You know, like that simple, right?
Yeah, the same way that like lots of people partner with like Amazon to use their like server like farms and stuff like that. Even if those other companies might be competing with Amazon in some areas.
Yeah.
Like these kinds of business deals happen a lot.
I really only put this on the outline, Sean, because I wanted to read the press release stuff because it was very fun to be that vague vocally. I love
it's that thing where they release a press release that all they really have to announce right now can be said in basically one sentence.
Yes.
And but somehow you can't just do a tweet. That's not how it works. So it's like somehow you have to write like a 3-paragraph press release on something that is 40 characters long.
All right. Anything else to say about this?
No, like I'm curious, like 5 years from now, what comes from this? Or like, and like, you know, it potentially could be something as little as like whatever like PS Now is on PS5 uses Microsoft Azure servers and like that's it. Like it's entirely possible that's actually all this is.
Yes. Finally this week, United States Senator Josh Hawley, recently elected Republican from Missouri, introduced legislation on May 8th to ban loot boxes and pay-to-win mechanics in video games, quote, played by minors. The act is called the Protecting Children from Abusive Games Act. This follows federal trade communication, FTC inquiries into such practices after the fall of 2017, i.e. the year of Battlefront 2, at which time Senator Maggie Hassan, a Democrat from New Hampshire, wrote to the FTC to prompt this inquiry. So this has been a bipartisan thing. Both sides have been kind of poking at this. Hawley has gone the furthest in introducing legislation. There is a lot to unpack here, and there is sort of good and bad. You know, Josh Hawley is the youngest member of the Senate. He unseated Claire McCaskill, Democrat, in the midterms. He is one of the guys who was like openly lying about healthcare. He had signed on to the lawsuit against Obamacare to get rid of pre-existing conditions and then recorded an ad where he said, I support pre-existing conditions. So he's a fucking liar. He has done a lot of anti-tech legislation in the Senate so far, mostly around this false idea that tech companies are censoring conservative voices. So he is kind of a troll on that. you know, I was listening to the Kotaku Split Screen podcast on this because I kind of wanted to learn more and hear what they had to say. And one of the things they were saying on that show to keep in mind is that conservatives at this point in time do rely on gamers a lot because of, like, the audience that came out of Gamergate and were radicalized in right-wing circles. And doing, like, hitting these kind of pressure points is probably in part a conservative strategy to, like, shore up these this, like, young male demographic that hates women and plays games.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I do think there should be inquiry into how we can legislate these things. Like, I would not be opposed to senators from both sides of the aisle getting together and talking about ways to regulate this industry that has absolutely gone out of control. But you really do have to kind of question some of the motives involved in this.
Yeah, like, because, yes, I, you know, whether it is something that has to come down to something the government has to pass, or, like, we manage to put enough pressure on the ESA to start making, like, specific changes, like, I definitely think that there needs to be way more action on how we regulate things like loot boxes, because it is predatory and gross and bad. Like one, I 100% do not think that this law will pass.
Of course not. It's
because, like, I think it would be extremely difficult for any law about this to be passed. Mostly because I think it would be very, very difficult to make the law specific enough that anyone would be comfortable, like, actually getting it all the way through. Because I think defining what constitutes, like, a harmful or predatory loot box practice in a legal sense is very hard. Which is why it's probably much easier ultimately to make changes on this by putting pressure on the ESA and for it to be more like unofficial guidelines that companies end up following, because I think legally it's going to be very, very hard for that to pass.
And, you know, the games industry has historically been pretty good at regulating itself and keeping this out. Like, the ESRB is, of all the different kinds of ratings boards you have for TV, movies, what have you, it is the best. It does the best at rating games. I think it is the most accurate in terms of describing content. It gives parents and consumers the most information. And it does a good job of allowing games to have mature adult experiences while having a rating system in place to kind of keep a check on that, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's a very good example. There's no reason they can't do something like that with loot boxes, but, you know, yeah, this isn't going to pass, but the fact that it has reached the attention of the United States Senate isn't nothing. And, you know, maybe all these fucking CEOs should have just been a little less selfish, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, make a little less money, and then you don't have to spend money lobbying later, right?
Yeah.
Guys, this isn't hard, you know?
Yeah, like, what I hope happens from this whole scenario is that, like, this law is not going to pass, but the ESA has to direct enough funds into lobbying specifically to fight this bill or other potential bills on this that could come into play, that like, the financial expenditure that the ESA has to make lobbying against this stuff forces them to be like, oh, like go to all the major publishers that are all members of the ESA and say, like, we need to, like, calm the fuck down, guys. Like, that's, I think, the most likely scenario that's going to happen that will come out with a advantageous outcome for people that, you know, want these things to be fixed up.
Gonna need to knock on the door of that Scrooge McDuck vault.
Yes.
Get all those CEOs out of their bathtub full of money and be like, hey, you've got enough.
You fucking idiots. Like, stop. Jesus Christ, you've got a good thing going. Stop fucking it up for yourself.
You fucked up a Star Wars game. That's so hard to do.
No, Jonathan, they fucked up every Star Wars game. That's a really hard thing to do.
Oh, man. All right. Yeah. And, you know, I did want to mention the connection to possible Gamergate stuff because...
Yeah, because that's the next generation of Republicans are Gamergaters, like 100%.
And we need to be very vigilant about that because I even remember, you know, back when Gamergate was starting on this podcast, I know I didn't do enough research in talking about it and understanding where it was really coming from.
What the fuck was happening.
And it's something I regret having talked about on this podcast is probably the way, like... I don't remember how the conversations went exactly, but we probably were too credulous talking about the ethics in journalism stuff, and we shouldn't have been. And I just think we all need to be careful going forward about, like, where to be credulous and where to be questioning. That's all I want to say on that.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move on, Sean. We've got three topics to do here.
Uh-huh.
I have played Cuphead. I want to talk about that. I want to bitch about Game of Thrones, and we want to talk about your anime. Do you want to save your anime for the end? Is it nice?
Yes, 100%. Okay. We have to end this podcast with me to telling you what Armored Trooper Bottoms is.
Then I'm going to start with Cuphead.
Okay, yeah.
All right, so Cuphead, if you don't know, was a Xbox exclusive when it came out. Microsoft, it's a small studio by these two brothers, Studio MDHR. Cuphead is a indie game that is made to look like a 1930s-style animated cartoon. So, like, think Fleischer Brothers, early Walt Disney, Steamboat Willie you mentioned earlier, Ub Iwerks, who was one of the big animators at Disney at the time. There's a lot of that in there. And it is all hand-animated, all hand-drawn, watercolors and stuff. Fucking gorgeous game. It was at E3 for years because it took a long time to develop, as you might imagine. A game that looks like that probably would. And then it finally came out in 2017 as an Xbox One and Windows 10 PC exclusive. It later came to Steam, it came to Mac a couple months ago, and then in March, late March, I think it came to Switch, where, as I said earlier, it's been cleaning up. I did actually try the game on Xbox, and I could not get into it, because Cuphead is hard. Mm-hmm. It is notoriously hard. It is a game that is basically all boss fights. It is, every level is Cuphead, who's this little guy with a cup for a head, and it's you cannot think about it too hard because he's got something sloshing around in his head, and he even takes the straw out of his head and drinks it, and I don't know what that is, but it's freaky. Hmm. Very fitting with, like, the 1930s animation style, which is also very freaky.
Yeah.
But it's all boss fights. Every level is, you go in, it's very tough, you have 3 hit points, that's it. And it's not 3 hit points and then you die, it's 2 hits and then you die.
Okay.
And so it's very unforgiving. It's a brutally difficult game. And when I tried it on Xbox, I just couldn't get into it. I have a certain aversion to certain types of difficult games. Like, give me a difficult RPG any day of the week. I'll do that. Fire Emblem, Persona, something like that.
Yeah,
I'm happy with that. But, you know, we've talked about my struggles with, like, Dark Souls before. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't quite get into it. But, you know, it came out on Switch. I was looking for something to play. Everyone was talking about this being on Switch. And also, like, it's a, like, pixel-perfect port. Like, Digital Foundry went over this. Like, it is the closest a game has ever been between, like, one of the big consoles and Switch, basically, because it's identical. And so I got it, and I kind of forced myself to get into it, and I have played 25 hours, according to my Switch clock so far. I have died over 1,300 times in Cuphead. I am almost done. I have completed all 3 worlds, and now I have the last 2 bosses, King Dice and then the Devil himself. And I have gone on a journey with this game where I've always loved the art style. It's unbelievable how well they got it. Like, you could take any image in this game, tell me that's from a 1930s cartoon, and I wouldn't bat an eyelash.
Mm-hmm.
It is just so fucking dead on. And the way it looks in movement, it is, I think it's probably one of the, like, 4 or 5 greatest visual achievements in the history of gaming. Like, it is up there. It is such an immense achievement. The music, too, like, It's a big band jazz soundtrack. I love jazz to begin with. I don't talk about that much on the show, but it is my jam. I fucking love it. But good God, this game is hard. And for a while, I'm like, am I Stockholm syndromed by this? Because, man, some of these bosses are fun, and some of them I'm spending 3 hours on and not getting anywhere, and it's I want to bang my head against a wall. You know, I did throw a remote at one point because I didn't want to throw one of my Joy-Con. They're expensive. You know, it's very difficult. I've gone up and down of being like, this game is bullshit, this game is brilliant. When I beat a boss, sometimes I feel like I'm king of the fucking world. Sometimes I feel like I'm dirt for spending so much time on that. And then I think I just fully passed the corner yesterday, Sean, where I was fighting what is somewhat widely considered to be the hardest boss of the main 3 worlds, which is there's this guy, this robot, Dr. Cal's robot. It's one of the levels where you're in a ship, so it's kind of like a bullet hell level, and it is crazy unforgiving. It's really hard, and I beat it once I got into it relatively easily. Like, I had extra health left at the end and stuff, and I felt so good. Like, I was in my room, I'm playing on my Switch, my dogs were sleeping on my bed, and I would like being like, yeah, and my dogs were like, what's going on? They could tell, like, something had happened, and I just realized, like, I fucking love this game, and it's definitely the hardest game I have ever played. I have never played I've not done with it yet. I don't know if I can beat it. We'll find out.
Yeah.
But I have never played a game this hard, certainly not for this long. Again, I've put 25 hours into this. And keep in mind, a completed boss run is usually 2 to 3 minutes.
Right.
So, like, if you could do them all in one go, this would be like a 2-hour game.
Yeah.
It's taken me 25 hours, and I've just fallen in love with it. I have one quibble with the controls, which is the parry system. We can talk about that later. But otherwise, it is such a tight, fluid set of controls. The bosses are so creative. There is generally such a good logic to the fights. It's crazy tough. I went on a rant about this on Twitter. It is not tough but fair. It is tough and unfair, and that's kind of the fucking point.
Okay.
And we can talk about that. But it is legitimately exhilarating to get to that point where you feel good enough to beat one of these guys, and either it's just scraping through or whatnot. I'm really kind of in love with this game. I'm shocked at how in love with this game I am. And having gone on the roller coaster of, like, loving it at times, hating myself for playing it at times, feeling like I want to play something else, but I can't tear myself away from this. And, like, over the last 2 or 3 weeks as I've been playing it, I've been trying to do other things. Like, I didn't talk about this, but I went back into Pokemon Let's Go after we did our Pokemon episode.
Yeah.
And I finished that game. Love that game. And I've been trying to finish my Pokedex. I'm almost done. I have to find someone I can trade with to finish my Pokedex. But, like, I would find I kept tearing myself away from Pokemon, which is much more relaxing, to go play Cuphead.
Uh-huh.
And I've been trying to play some other things. But I always want to keep coming back to Cuphead. And now it's just my obsession. And, you know, I've never quite had this with a difficult game. And, you know, all I'll say is I realized I was almost done with the game last night and I priced out Dark Souls again. Because I'm like, I'm going to start chasing this dragon now.
Uh-huh.
That's who I am, I guess. Because, I don't know, I love being punished. I guess I'm a masochist. It's very weird. This game has done something to me, Sean.
Well, now at least you can fucking play Sekiro.
Yes, that's that. I said Dark Souls. I'm probably, what I really want to play is Sekiro because it's new and, yeah.
Because I think my suspicion is one of the reasons why you could push through Cuphead is because you like the aesthetic so much. And I think you will like the aesthetic of Sekiro a lot more than Dark Souls. Because I do.
Well, and I want to play Sekiro. It's just where I am right now. I just have my Switch with me.
Makes sense.
I did not take my PS4 on a plane.
Yeah. But, yeah, no, I mean, as someone who plays more, like, really hard games than you do on average, like, it is the feeling of accomplishment you can get from playing, like, a really difficult boss that you have to bang your head against multiple times. Like, you know, for me in Sekiro, it took me, like, it's like if I wasn't playing the game like 3 days straight, but it was the process of picking up and trying over the course of 3 days to beat the last boss. Like, that's how long it took me right at the very end of that game to, like, be able to finally, like, understand that boss and be able to beat it. But once I beat it, like, it was a truly exhilarating feeling that, you know, Mafia 3 will never be able to give me, like, 1/100th of the feeling, you know, that I got from finishing a game like Sekiro, partially because of that, like, incredible difficulty it can put on the player.
Because Cuphead is really interesting in its structure, because it is all boss fights. There's a world map that's really fun to go around, but it's all boss fights. There are 20 of those, and then there are 6 run-and-gun levels, which are side-scrollers, but they are also very, very tough, just as tough in a different way. So every level you do in Cuphead is a project, is how I've been thinking about it. Like, you do not sit down for Cuphead for like half an hour and be like, I'm going to beat a boss. You sit down, if you have half an hour, and be like, I'm going to see what this boss is like or something.
Yeah.
And if you want to beat it, for me, it's been in the earlier stages, like maybe give myself an hour, sometimes more than that. Some of these guys have taken me 3, 4, 5. But like, if you are in that mindset, and especially I've also learned like my own patterns with Cuphead, like if you beat a boss in Cuphead, don't go celebrate by trying to fight another boss in Cuphead.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Take that victory and sleep with it.
Yes.
Like, take it with you and, like, live with that victory in your life for a little bit and cherish it. Because, yeah, if you immediately dump it to the next boss, you're probably going to get your ass handed to you again because the boss is completely different. And you're, like, and then that high is completely destroyed.
Yeah. And, you know, I think learning more about, like, how I should play the game, how I should approach it, I really liked. And, you know, I've also realized, I think, when this game was coming out, the first thing that attracted a lot of us was the art style.
Yeah.
And then I think a lot of people were like, well, wait, why is this art style going to this like super hardcore boss-driven game? And playing it for myself, I think there's a real logic to it that aesthetically all works together, which to me is that if you look at the era of cartoons they are pulling from, and the kinds of cartoons in particular, those are mean little cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a lot of cartoons in the 30s are just, they're kind of mean.
They're racist. Dirty,
they're racist. They're ugly in a lot of ways. Like characters just do mean things. And, like, there's a certain, like, subversive quality to that, to putting that in a game that is all about punishing the player. Like, Cuphead is a little fucking bastard.
Uh-huh.
All of the cartoons are just little fucking bastards. And that feels very appropriate for a game that is going to make you hit your head against a wall.
Uh-huh.
Like, I think it actually works way better than I was anticipating. Like, if this were a game that was just a fun walk in the park, that art style would feel very false to me.
Uh-huh.
So I really like how they've done it. You know, I went on a little Twitter rant. It was not about the game so much. It was about the way people talk about it. Because I kept hearing in every review, like, Cuphead is really tough, but it's fair, don't worry. And I hear that in, like, I think people use the term tough but fair in game criticism now to just mean a game that was challenging and I enjoyed it.
Uh-huh.
It's like used interchangeably. It's like, no, it's fucking not. Cuphead is a game that you have 3 hit points. You have this tiny little pea shooter. The bosses take literally thousands of hits to kill, and they can kill you in 2 hits. Like, it's not fair. The game also, and I think this is one of the smarter things about it, it has a lot of randomization to it. So, like, the bosses have patterns that you will recognize by their motions, and this is part of why the animation makes this game so eminently playable, is it is so expressive. Like, recognizing boss patterns and attacks is a lot more manageable in a game like this than in, say, a pixel art game or even a lot of 3D games, because it's hand animated. They can give you all of that character, but the bosses will not, like, if you boot up the level, it's not every time they will do the exact same thing. It's that they have a set of moves and they will do them in certain orders, which on one hand keeps you on your toes a lot more, and I think at its best makes this game really fun because it feels like it's not rote memorization, it's actual skill at points.
Yeah.
But it also means there are points where you just have to get fucking lucky. Because there are runs where, like, things are going to come in a point where, like, no, it's not humanly possible to dodge that. I'm going to take a hit here and that's going to fuck me. And I just have to retry, and you kind of have to accept that.
Mm-hmm.
So my rant was more about, like, the whole tough but fair thing. It's like, it's not. Like, this game is patterned after, like, NES difficulty. Like, it reminds me at points of, like, the kinds of games the angry video game nerd reviews on his show. Like,
yeah.
Silver Surfer or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, these crazy fucking hard NES games. They have an audience. And it's like, it's okay to admit that you like being tortured by these games. I clearly do. I've played 25 fucking hours of it. But it's not fair. And that's kind of part of the fun of it. Like, you talked about this with Sekiro, where you explained, like, Dark Souls has a lot of, like, just things are going to pop out and kill you and you won't know until you try it.
Yeah, you, like, walk on a bridge and then a dragon flies out of nowhere and roasts you, which is, like, one of the reasons why I stopped playing Demon's Souls was, a big lot of bullshit around that part,
And that's not tough but fair. That's tough and unfair. And that's okay. I think Cuphead is kind of a masterpiece of that kind of game design, especially the more I play it. And again, there's the hardest one I've had in this game, and the only one that truly left me frustrated was this one with a dragon where you have to jump on these different clouds, and, like, I finally figured it out, but it took, like, 3 or 4 hours. It was almost my breaking point, and I do think that one is just a little poorly constructed. But there's ones where, like, there's one where you fight this candy lady who, like, she lives in, like, a candy castle, and there's 4 stages to the fight, and in the first 2 or 3 there's 4 different enemies that could come out, but it will be random which ones you face, and so you just have to get good at knowing what those 4 are, and then you start to string strategies together, and then the last part is fighting her herself. That is one of my favorites in this game. It's very randomized, but it feels very well calibrated to create a really interesting challenge that makes you come up with skills and strategies. Again, it is a terrifyingly difficult game, but especially after that robot, Sean, I looked at that robot the first time and I thought, that is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
This will be the end of me. This is as far as I'm going to make it on Cuphead. I was watching online like video tutorials about it where people are like, yeah, this one's really hard, guys. Like, even the people who make YouTube videos were like, don't worry, it's easy. These guys were like, no, this one's really hard. And I figured it out partially just on my own. I came up with, like, kind of my own strategy on it, and it was the greatest fucking feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I kind of love Cuphead. I don't even kind of. I really love this game. It's so perfect on Switch because it actually, in some ways, is easier on the smaller screen because you can see everything at once.
Right, yeah.
On a big 50-inch TV, like, there's so much going on. Sometimes I'm looking over here and I need to be looking over here. And it looks so good on both versions. The Joy-Cons are fine for it. Like, it's It's an amazing, amazing game. They're doing DLC later this year, and I'm excited for that. If they do a sequel, I think there are cool things they could improve on. Like, again, there's this parry system where you jump on pink objects, and it's there's two things about it. It's too finicky, and even like experts making YouTube videos have agreed it's too finicky. And then also, it's kind of a weird risk-reward system where the risk is if you do a parry but miss, you're going to lose a health point, which you only have a few of. But the reward is you fill your meter at the bottom that allows you to do super attacks, and the super attacks are not useful enough for that risk-reward. Like, I kind of wish the parry did something like giving you invincibility frames or giving you a health back if you do enough of them or something. Like, that would be a better risk-reward system. There are some enemies where it's used as just a part of the fight, and I love it there because it's something you have to do. And like it becomes integral to the game itself. But in most of the levels, like, it's smarter to just ignore the parries, and I think that's probably a mistake. But yeah, like, the more this is one of those games where I think this is the sign of a hard game being good is the more I play it and the more I understand the systems, the more I like it, mm-hmm. and the more I feel like it is torturing me. This game is sadistic as all fuck, but like, I like it. This is cool.
Yeah, like, it'll be interesting to see, like, if you finish it, because with a game like that, it's always an if, but if you finish it and you play through it again, if it's kind of like when I played Sekiro, for, like, a full New Game Plus run, and just, like, blasted through that fucking game. Like, yeah. My New Game Plus run of Sekiro was, like, 6 to 8 hours long. I'm curious to see if you play Cuphead again, if you just be like, oh yeah, I know this boss, oh, I know this boss, and you beat it in like an hour.
I did go back to World 1 and did a couple of them, like the ones that were too hard for me back on Xbox.
Yeah.
And yeah, that happened. I was just like, okay, that fucking carrot stood no chance.
Yeah, because like with that Sekiro New Game Plus run, like it took me again, like playing over the course of 3 days to beat that final boss the first time. On my second playthrough, I beat that final boss on my third try the second time.
So it's
like that feeling of like, I've got you down, but like you can't do shit to me, is so like intoxicating almost.
Yeah. I, you know, and I think there are some things they could add for difficulty that like, I wouldn't necessarily want an easy, like there is a simple mode you can play the bosses on, but I'm not sure why it's there because you can't advance through the game on it. It doesn't count as finishing the boss. But it's also, like, what I would think you would want is, like, a practice mode where you could just go in there and see what the patterns are. Like, so instead of going and watching a YouTube video, I could do it for myself.
Yeah.
That, they don't have that. Simple mode just means the bosses have, like, half as much health, so you kill them without seeing their full pattern.
Oh.
So there's no reason for it to be there. I would love some kind of, like, rehearsal mode where it's like, I want to see that third phase. Let me see the third phase again. And obviously, to advance through the game, you would have to string it all together and do it at once. I think there's things like that that could be creative solutions and make more... Because I have heard from a lot of people, like, it's too much for them, and I get that.
Yeah.
Again, 25 hours is a lot, but, you know, that's in the future. If they ever want to do a sequel, I think there's ways they could even expand on
it. Yeah, because that's always, like, you know, going back to old NES games like Castlevania and stuff, like, that's always the thing that pushes, like, the length of the game and, like, the frustration out the most is, like... You know, fuck, like, I have to beat the first two phases of Dracula, like, fucking 15 times before I can see the third phase enough to be able to live for more than 30 goddamn seconds. Like, and, that kind of thing.
And Cuphead, I think at its worst, gets into that kind of frustration. But at its best, it's like, I got to the last 30 seconds again. This is exciting.
Yeah.
Let me tell you about King Dice. So King Dice is the penultimate boss and the hardest one, because King Dice is a boss rush.
Okay,
where
yeah.
He's in a casino and you have a roulette table that goes left to right and it's got boss 1, 2, 3, clear space. 4, 5, 6, clear space. 7, 8, 9, finish space. You have a dice in the middle of the screen you have to hit, and it's a dice with 1, 2, and 3, and it'll advance you along that board. So depending on how you do it, you could have to fight 9 bosses and then King Dice. Or you could try to get the rolls well enough so you have to do a minimum of 3, and then you could fight him. And if you hit on the right ones, you also get extra health across the fights. That's what I've been spending. I spent my morning playing that. I'm nowhere near good enough to beat it yet, but I've gotten 2 King Dice once, and I have already started to feel like, okay, I know what my strategy is. I know how to get there. I'm going to have to figure out how to fight King Dice at the end. But, like, I'm putting it together. I don't feel like it's going to be impossible. I'm actually very excited to undergo the process of getting good enough to beat King Dice. Like, the biggest hurdle is going to be figuring out that fucking dice block and getting the right rolls. But that's the kind of sadism this game engages in.
Yeah, boss rushes are always that's a big ask from a game. To be like a, you know, it's that Mega Man thing of just like, fuck, okay, I guess I have to fight all these motherfuckers now, sure, okay.
But, you know, I think the best thing I can say for Cuphead is it earns it.
Cool.
Unlike our next topic, Game of Motherfucking Thrones.
I love this. I love, you know, you have like a couple of times over the course of this podcast asked me if to like maybe start watching Game of Thrones so we could talk about it on the podcast. And I was just always like, like maybe. And then I have to just sort of put it off. I love now that it's like, it's only when Game of Thrones has gotten so disastrously bad that it's just like, yeah, fuck it. We're just gonna talk about Game of Thrones.
It's when I no longer feel bad about spoiling it for you.
Yeah.
Oh my God. All right. Spoilers for, you know what? Why are you listening to this if you haven't seen Game of Thrones? Why does everyone feel the need to put spoiler warnings? You're adults. You can figure it the fuck out. There's a time code in the show notes. If you don't want to hear about Game of Thrones, Sean's going to tell us about a funny anime. Or I don't know if it's funny, but you're going to say things.
Oh, it's a great anime that is fucking ridiculous.
Okay. Skip ahead to that. It's in the show notes. I'll have it all down there for you to the second. It's hard work to do that. Not really. I go into iTunes. It's fine. But yeah, spoilers for Game of Thrones. So last time we talked, Sean, they had aired episode 3, The Battle of Winterfell. It was called The Long Night. And that was where they defeated the Night King and all the zombies.
Yes, with Lady Me from Doctor Who stabbed the zombie man.
Yes. And it was a very disappointing episode for a variety of reasons. And I was now very sad and worried Game of Thrones was not going to end well. It got so much worse, Sean.
Uh-huh.
It got so much worse. Like, that's just tip of the iceberg. Nothing from episodes 1, 2, and 3 has been fucking mentioned in episodes 4 and 5. They didn't matter. It was a filler arc. It was bullshit. Like
it's the Garlic Jr. saga of Game of Thrones.
Pretty much, if the Garlic Jr. saga was delivered piecemeal through all 291 episodes of Dragon Ball Z and ended right before Kid Buu shows up.
Jesus. That's a dark fucking thing to imagine.
Yes. And you didn't realize Garlic Jr. was bad until the very end.
Yeah, you saw this like, man, this Garlic Jr. guy seems really important. Like, he's taking over. Like all these people are evil now. Man, it's got to be super important. Oh, they just killed him. Okay. Like, so, fucking Krillin showed up and beat him with a Kamehameha. Okay, let's move on.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It's been so frustrating, the discourse around it, because... So these last two episodes, they've switched gears, and now it's all about the war in the South for King's Landing and the seat of power in Westeros. And these last two episodes, which were called The Last of the Starks and The Bells, have been so bad in so many ways. And I think what people don't... there's kind of the pro and anti Game of Thrones crowd right now.
Uh-huh.
And... what a lot of the people who are like, it's fine, you guys don't get, like, just because you don't like where the story's going doesn't mean it's bad. No one's saying that.
Yeah.
At least on my circles. No one's saying that the story inherently, like, the things that happened in these two episodes that aired the last 2 weeks, all of them could be, most of them could be really interesting plot points that could be very powerfully, if given the time to breathe and flesh out and be organically developed. If you are doing it like you're adapting Spark Notes, it doesn't fucking work. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. My absolute breaking point was in episode 4, where... So Daenerys and her army, they're traveling by ship, and they're going to go to her ancestral home of Dragonstone, which is near enough to King's Landing that she can launch her assault from there. And she's got her ships, they're sailing. She has her two dragons, she has two dragons now, and they're flying above. They're heading to Dragonstone. And Sean, this is how it happens. Out of the fucking blue, they're flying. An arrow goes through one of the dragon's neck. Another goes through its head. It falls and dies. And that's the last we ever talk about that fucking dragon. Like, it is just out of the blue. And then Daenerys is like, oh shit, where'd that come from? And they look down. And a entire fleet has surprise attacked them on open water. Which, we'll get into that.
Yeah.
This entire fleet with these giant arrows... And then they start attacking Daenerys' fleet with the giant arrows. And while I can understand how a giant arrow could kill a dragon, I don't understand how an arrow, no matter how large, could literally tear a wooden ship in half. But it starts doing that to all the ships of Daenerys' fleet. And then we kind of cut, and Daenerys and her people are like getting up on shore. We really don't know how many ships she has left. We don't know where the other fleet went. Euron Greyjoy's surprise attack fleet. I guess they just retreated or something, which is weird. And yeah... And that was the point where I realized, oh, they don't give a shit anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And again, not the people directing the show, not the people building the sets, not the people doing the visual effects, not the actors. That's all great. That's never not been good. Game of Thrones is a well-made show. We're talking about the writing. There's a reason movies and TV shows have scripts, because if they're not good, the other stuff can't be good, yeah. Right? And, I mean, my God, Sean, I'm kind of a naval nerd. I like reading naval novels like the Patrick O'Brien, Aubrey Maturin series, Master and Commander. I don't think you need to know a goddamn thing about naval warfare to know that it is impossible to do a surprise attack with a naval fleet on open waters.
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, for people who haven't seen the ocean before, it's very big and it's very flat. And when you're in the middle of it on the boat, and also boats that are manned by dozens and dozens, all of them are manned by dozens and dozens of people, and you have a whole shit of them. So there's literally like hundreds of people looking out in every possible conceivable angle to cover every single direction any attack could come from for an open, flat waters. You are right, Jonathan. It is literally fucking impossible to sneak attack someone.
And I think what they were implying in the geography of the episode is that the Euron Greyjoy's magical mystery fleet, which we have to talk about anyway, because that fleet is fucking ridiculous. Because this is also, by the way, that's the third time Euron has done that with his fleet in the last two seasons. So he has a magical fleet that can surprise attack people. I think they were trying to imply he's hiding behind some rocks at Dragonstone. It still doesn't work, I'm sorry, because he has a whole fleet. You can't hide a bunch of fleets, but like a fleet behind one rock, that doesn't work. But like, even then... why would Daenerys Targaryen not send a scout ahead to her ancestral home? Why would she assume that no one would be waiting there for her? Why are we supposed... like, she's supposed to be the queen. Like, she's going to take over Westeros. And she's too stupid not to send a fucking scouting party ahead to see, hey, did Cersei Lannister maybe send some people to my ancestral home that is near King's Landing that she knew I might be going to launch an attack out of? I hate to be like the nitpicky plot hole person, but I don't think that's a nitpick. Like, yeah. That's especially when it's one of her two dragons who are established on the show as like her children. She loves them more than anything in the world, and they just die out of the blue because of this colossal failure of military planning. Why are we supposed to accept that? Like, that's the point for me, Sean, where it went from I cannot accept anything that happens in the rest of this series because that pivotal point was so colossally dumb.
And because it seems to me, again, as someone who has not seen any Game of Thrones episode to completion, I've walked past when my brother was watching an episode, and be like, oh, I guess that's Game of Thrones. Okay. That's the most direct experience I have with this series. But interacting with lots of people over the past 10 years or however long it's been, who have, you know, liked Game of Thrones and they've heard conversations about it or they've talked to me about why they like it. Most people, the main thing I get from it is there's like a certain amount of sort of thoughtful psychological realism to the characters and this very big cast of characters that like people become very fixated with because there's a depth and sort of naturalism and realism to the way the characters are portrayed in a fantasy setting that people really, really like. Which is why when all of a sudden you have to just wildly jerk the show around to try to get plot things to happen, the first thing that gets jettisoned is the psychological realism of the characters because you just need characters to do things for plot to happen, not characters doing things because it's the natural thing that the character would do and have the plot occur naturally from that point, which seems to be what like Game of Thrones has built itself on up to this point.
You hit the nail on the head, and I think this is great. No other podcast is doing the person watching Game of Thrones and person never having seen it. It's a spoiler cast, but I think we're nailing it.
Yeah.
So... and yes, you're absolutely right. And the thing is, this wasn't just some one-off. This is pivotal, because what happens in that scene with Euron's Magical Mystery Fleet, which, just to back up why I call it the Magical Mystery Fleet, in Season 6, Euron becomes King of the Iron Islands, and his sister, Asha, her name is Asha in the books, I don't remember what it is in the show, Asha steals the entire Iron Fleet and leaves, and he is abandoned on the Iron Islands with no ships, and the Iron Islands are also a like natural resources poor environment. By the end of the season, he is back with an entire fleet of ships. So it already started of like, he built that fleet out of nothing, because you need a lot of wood to build a fleet of ships.
Yeah.
Then he did a surprise attack in Season 7 where he came up on Asha's fleet and killed them all, which, again, is impossible on open waters. And that one truly was on open waters. Then he did it again... I forget the second... Oh, he did it to kidnap Theon at some point. I don't forget. But it happened again, and then there was the one in this episode where he kills the dragon. So all of that... So Magical Mystery Fleet is dumb.
Yeah.
But the point is, in this scene, Daenerys loses her dragon. So now she only has one of her three dragons left. That is a trauma. In this scene, Missandei, her handmaiden and, like, right-hand woman, is also kidnapped by Cersei's forces, and then at the end of the episode is executed by Cersei in front of Daenerys. And all of this pushes Daenerys into a very dark place. That dark place manifests in episode 5, The Bells, when out of the fucking blue, she decides to kill every man, woman, and child in King's Landing. Now, as you might be able to tell, Sean, that's a pretty big decision for a character to make, to commit genocide.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if her committing genocide was predicated directly on a sequence of events in the previous episode that made no goddamn sense, maybe there's a reason some of us are saying, hey, that rang a little fucking hollow when she genocided all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah, because, again, from the outside, this is, like, purely stuff I've absorbed from overhearing other teachers' conversations and basically Twitter. It seems, because I'm with you, I have seen two different kinds of discussions. I've seen people very upset of feeling like the show has just rushed every single plot point to an absurd degree and had to just make, again, like wildly jerking the show around to get plot things to happen. And then there's other people saying, like, but these things have been foreshadowed. And it's like this... It's like two groups of people, like, talking past each other in this way that's, like what Twitter fucking always is. But it's like, nobody's talking about that these things were not foreshadowed. I've not seen one person be like, these are not the plot events that should occur. It's always people saying, like, these plot events should have occurred over the course of, like, three more seasons of this television show if this is what they wanted it to do at the ending. And other people saying, like, well, no, but they foreshadowed in this episode, like, that Daenerys would get angry. It's like, well, but that's not the point. Like, you can't, like, especially in a work of... That, again, is it trying to approach some sort of psychological realism with its characters. Foreshadowing doesn't matter for shit. Because foreshadowing only matters in, like, thematic sense. It doesn't matter in character sense.
No.
It doesn't matter if you foreshadow an event. It doesn't make it then that character, when that event has to occur, that automatically you have, like, the green light for that character making whatever choice it is. You always have to do the groundwork for the character to slowly build up to that point, especially if it's a TV show that's been going on for eight fucking seasons, you know? Like, people are used to a certain pace. You can't just shift that pace on them and expect them to accept it.
And at the very end.
Yeah.
You know? Like, yeah, it's... So let's back up. In episode 5, what happens is they attack King's Landing, where Cersei and her forces are. They win the battle, and everyone surrenders. So all the soldiers lay down their arms, they ring the bells, which is the signal that they are surrendering, and they have won the war. Dany is sitting there on one of the parapets with her dragon, which, by the way, I should also mention, she was able to take... She and her dragon were able to effortlessly take out all of those arrows that killed her other dragon.
There you go. Well, they didn't sneak attack her on open water, so of course easier able to deal with this threat.
So she's sitting there on the parapet with the dragon, and she's looking at the Red Keep where Cersei is, and she's like... And again, she's won the war. It's over. There's no more fighting. And she decides, fuck it, and she starts torching civilians... And she burns down King's Landing. We see the rest of the episode. It's a 90-minute episode. And a solid 45 minutes of it, Sean, like the length of a normal TV episode, is watching Daenerys on her dragon fly around burning women and children alive. She never even gets to the Red Keep and kills Cersei. Cersei dies from falling debris later in the episode. She's just killing women and children and random innocent people. Like... And this is where we get to the issue. I think the notion of Game of Thrones climaxing on Daenerys Targaryen, who we thought at one point was the hero, kind of breaking bad and doing a bad thing, is very interesting. And I think it is probably where George R. R. Martin is headed, but he's doing it very meticulously.
Mm-hmm.
The show, this is like, let me back up. Let's take an example of the Star Wars prequels.
Okay.
I know not everyone loves those movies.
Yes.
As an understatement. But I think most people would agree that those movies trace the arc of Anakin Skywalker from innocent boy to murderer pretty well.
Yeah.
Like, that's one thing people tend to agree on, right? And there is a ton of foreshadowing in it, right? Like, Yoda's like, I don't know about this kid. That's foreshadowing. But they also do the things like, He was wrenched from his home when he was 10. And when his mother died, he killed a bunch of innocent Jawas. And he did this, this, and this. And, like, there's all this darkness and pettiness. And he talked to Padme about how he should be in charge of everything. And, like, so when the moment came for him to swear allegiance to Darth Sidious, it doesn't feel like it's coming out of the fucking blue.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones did the foreshadowing of people said, like, over and over again, you don't want to be Queen of the Ashes, Daenerys. And she's like, correct, I do not want to be Queen of the Ashes. But all of her other actions were things like rescuing women from rapists, and rescuing women from slavery, and children from slavery, and freeing people, and doing all these things that, like, she had a sense of justice. And yes, sometimes she had a temper and did hot-headed things, but they were always two military enemies. And frankly, most of her what she has done on the show that people say is bad is fully justified in the field of war. Like, if you tell someone to bend the knee and they don't bend the knee, yeah, you have to execute them. I'm sorry, it is medieval warfare. Like, mm-hmm. I wouldn't do it, but I'm not in fucking 1392 yeah. or whatever. You know, like, so, yeah. So, like, yes, they have foreshadowed that she has had ancestors who were crazy, and people are warning her not to do anything too horrible, but she has never shown the slightest inclination towards hurting innocents. She had no motivation to hurt innocents in this episode. Like, what people have said, and I agree, is that if what happened in the Bells was she was just really mad at Cersei, and she went straight for the Red Keep, and in attacking the Red Keep, there was, like, fallout that killed civilians, that would make sense. Like, in her rage, she didn't think of the fallout of her actions and went too far. But that's not what she does. She purposefully commits a genocide on the people of King's Landing, the seat of power in Westeros. And that, if you try to tell me that was in any way organically built to in that episode or in the show, you're a fucking idiot and I'm not going to listen to you, because it's not there. It just isn't. In no way is it there. And it really frustrates me how much of a pass they're getting on this from some corners of fandom who are like, but the episode was so well made. It was, absolutely, but I hated that episode deeply because watching 45 minutes of very beautifully orchestrated violence feels like pornographic to me when it has no underlying motivation. Mm-hmm. It's misery porn. It's just like, look how cool it is to watch all these women and children burn. I'm sorry, you have to connect it to someone. Like, the fallout of those images is too big to be so willy-nilly with how you play it. Like, you can't feel like, we want to have all these images, let's reverse engineer from there. You have to build up to it.
Yeah.
And they just don't. And it is the kind of mistake in ending a show that retroactively makes me like so much of the series less, because it means so much of it meant nothing in the ultimate, like, push towards an ending. And I'm not usually that kind of person. Like, I can't think of a show that got so bad down the home stretch that I personally started hating it. That's never happened to me. Like, there are shows like The Office that get worse in their last two seasons, but it's a comedy, and, like, I don't care if season 9 of The Office is kind of bad. I don't need season 9 to be good for season 3 to be good. But in Game of Thrones, it's kind of predicated on the idea that this is heading somewhere. And I've never been this fundamentally disappointed by a piece of media, ever in my life. And it's kind of heartbreaking, but I also realized, like, in this episode, like, I just don't care. Like, there were nice moments in this episode with some characters, and I just felt dead inside because they've rushed it so extremely. It feels like the people writing it are just checked out of the show. Like, they are trying to, like, get it done and then go for spring break or something, or in this case, go to write Star Wars.
Uh-huh.
And it's just, it's really disappointing. I've never seen anything like it.
The thing that is the most, again, as someone who has no buy-in, and, like, no, like, stake in this at all, the part I thought was the funniest, as someone who's heard bits and pieces about Game of Thrones over the course of as long as the show has been running, was finding out that Cersei dies from rubble falling on her. Just is, like, the most, like, a man, like, yeah, this is what I dreamed it would be of the anime only ending to Game of Thrones that it is of, like, that's the most anime ass, like, shit, like, we have to come up with an ending to a story we did not start writing kind of thing of, like, your character that seems to have been, like, basically your main sort of overarching villainous character for the longest time, Because like that's the way that people talk about Cersei, is like they love her and love to hate her kind of thing.
She's there in the pilot to now, like she's
like she's one of the majorest characters that has. I don't know who she kills or why or what, but I get the sense that she kills lots of people and people like love to hate her, and hate to love her, and it's that kind of character. And to find out that she just gets killed by like falling rebel, and it's not like a personal like one other character finally kills her kind of thing. It's like a. How do you fuck that up? That seems like it was the easiest to tee up for anything in the show would be give this cool character a, like, cool death. Because that was, like, the main focal point for the conversation I was overhearing. Was, like one of the teachers was like, I just can't really quite believe that that character's actually dead. Because surely that there's someone else pops in. Lady Mi from Doctor Who shows up. Because, of course, that's why we all know her as. Pops up and kills her, or someone, right? And it's like, and I kept overhearing that as someone who, again, doesn't really give a shit and read what the leaked ending for this season is.
I did too.
Yeah, we're not saying it here, but maybe that character, if that the leak is true, maybe that character's just dead.
Yeah, like, no, she is. She's dead. Yeah, and she's it's dead. Like,
it's like, yeah, you're not getting the like. And again, that's the most anime only ending type shit of like, and there's no way that this is how it is. And it's like, no, this is definitely how it is. I'm sorry that you have to go through this.
Yeah. It's, Cersei is the thing that baffles me most this season.
Mm-hmm.
Because even when the show was at its roughest in seasons 5 and 7, I would say, Cersei was the shining light of the show. To a point where I would say, if there was one thing I thought the show consistently did better than the books, it was Cersei Lannister. Lena Headey's performance and Benioff and Weiss's writing... They got that character. And even when they went off book in season 5, they did Cersei so well in season 5, in season 6, even in season 7. Like, they had good stuff for her, and Lena Headey was great. It's like, other than... I mean, they fucked up every woman at one point or another in the show. But, like, Cersei was the woman they most consistently wrote well and never fell into really bad tropes on, I thought. And then this season, she disappeared. She's in episode 1 in one scene, and it's very minor. She's not in episode 2. She's not in episode 3. She's in one scene of episode 4 and says nothing. In episode 5, she has almost no dialogue before dying. Like, she just was taken off the board. She's just a pawn in the game. Everyone else is talking about Cersei. She has no role. I guarantee you, George R. R. Martin will not be doing that because she's a point of view character and has internal monologue. So, like, he can't do that because his characters inherently have interiority. So it's like... Them fucking Cersei up is like the final betrayal, because it's like the one they never fucked up, and they fucked her up in the end. And it was, because it's not just that she got crushed by rubble, it's all the stuff with Jaime, her brother slash lover, and like, Jaime, I would love to sit down Benioff and Weiss and be like, describe Jaime's arc, and hear them try to do it, because it's so fucked up. Because they went on such weird tangents with him where, like, once they decided to go off book with Jaime, they went off book hard and took him in the weirdest directions and, like, were never clear where his loyalties were. In episode 4, they had him get into in the span of a single episode, he gets into a romance with Brienne, who they were never romantic before. It was actually a really cool platonic relationship, and they decided, let's fuck this up for the fans before we end by having them fuck, and it gets really weird. And then 20 minutes later in the same episode, he decides to abandon Brienne to go back to King's Landing and be with Cersei, and they leave Brienne, who was this, you know, one of the best characters, just standing there crying because her man left her, which feels bad.
Uh-huh.
And then Jaime goes back, and he has no real crisis of faith. He just wants to be with his sister lover, and then they hug and get crushed by rubble, and that's the end of the episode. And it's like, again, yeah, it's like the anime only ending of like, that's definitely not in the books.
Yeah, like that's definitely not how. Or if like if they, you know, if George R. R. Martin gave them a note of like, and then you know Cersei dies in this attack on King's Landing, that's like maybe if they get killed by rubble, it's a like, oh, in the middle of this sword fight, something cool happens and the dragon knocks a pillar over and the castle falls down on her. It's like the symbolism and all this shit is like. Oh, we'll just have a rock fall on her head. It's just like, it's the most like William Shatner's death in Star Trek Generations shit I have ever heard. And straight up, I am so excited to watch this TV show now, hearing how bad it fucks up at the end. It makes me so much worse just sitting actually watching the show for reasons I don't know I could describe.
I do kind of get it. I'm glad someone here has enthusiasm for Game of Thrones, and it's the person who's never watched it. Because, man, because they also fucked up. My favorite character in the history of the show was the Hound, Sandor Clegane. And they had some really cool opportunities to do stuff with him in this last episode, and I feel like they're just wasted. And the whole, like, there was, so in the show, so there's the Hound is a character who has a brother named the Mountain, and the Mountain is sort of evil, Gregor Clegane. And Gregor Clegane, as a boy, like, tortured his brother, and Sandor hates him, and so Sandor, for most of the show, wanted revenge on his brother. And this led a lot of fans to create this meme that you've probably seen, Sean, of the Clegane Bowl.
Yes, I've seen that word be thrown around a lot on Twitter.
And so we finally got the Clegane Bowl in this episode, and it's bad, and it's dumb, and it completely betrays, I think, Sandor Clegane's actual character arc, which was not a single focus thing on revenge, but was becoming a human. Mm-hmm. And he, in the end, he had become a human, and then he goes and fights a zombie and dies, which is not what humans do. So, like, they fucked up his arc, and they did it all to fulfill a fucking meme. Like, that's how bad Game of Thrones has gotten, is that they're writing based on memes. It's so insulting. But, yeah, that's probably all the gas I have in the tank for this one. We'll have the finales airing tomorrow night. This podcast I'm going to put out actually on Sunday, so you can listen before the finale if you want. But, like, we're going to have to do one more therapy session next week.
I'm so excited.
I've read the leaks. And the thing is, because I read the leaks a couple weeks ago because I was just so frustrated after episode 4. And I was like, you know what? If this were the books, I could see this being a good ending because Martin would take the time and care to do it. In the show, the way they've been doing it, like, this is the craziest thing, Sean, is that they had been moving at a pretty good pace for 6 seasons. And then Benioff and Weiss inexplicably said, we only are going to do 13 more episodes. And everyone on Earth said, that doesn't seem like enough time to wrap up this story that in no way feels like it's at the end. But they're like, no, we're only doing 13. And HBO, for some inexplicable reason we are never going to understand, decided instead of, like, getting new showrunners, like, it's not their story. It's George R.R. Martin's. You could get someone else to write the fucking show if they really are that checked out.
Yeah.
They said, okay, we're going to cancel our most popular show ever and do it with 13 episodes left, which is less than a season and a half of the normal show, when I would say the plot of season 7 and 8 needed, at a minimum, 3 full-length seasons. Mm-hmm. Like, this episode and what I assume the finale will be feels like it should have been a full season, not 2 episodes.
Yeah.
Like, good God. Good God. This show.
I'm so excited to start watching it. I think I'm going to start watching it once the semester is done.
Okay.
I'm going to...
Well, we'll have some fun. I'm actually reading the books again because, at least the first book, because it's a little shorter and I'm having fun with it and it's reminding me what I love about the series and it's like, it's keeping me evened out.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll talk about that. And like I said, if you're going to watch that, I'll have to watch Gundam to give you something in
return.
Yes,
100%. We have to do Gundam. Also, while I'm thinking about it, for all the people like you, Jonathan, people listening to this that are just really frustrated that Game of Thrones is completely fucked up at the end, I've got one recommendation for you. Just get super deep into Romance of the Three Kingdoms.
Okay.
It's so good. It basically has all the shit you want, but like most of it is that like somewhat based in historical fact, and it's got a super long book you can read. And a really good TV show that I can rip the DVDs for you and you can watch the TV show.
Same and way. The TV show didn't fuck up at the end, right?
Yeah, no, the TV show's fucking amazing and awesome, and I'm assuming probably much better than Game of Thrones.
I actually do have it on my phone. Because I'm reading Game of Thrones on my phone because I have them all on Kindle. And I realized I have the translation you recommended of Romance of the Three Kingdoms on my phone. So maybe on the flight back, I'll have to start.
There you go. Just get super deep into Romance of the Three Kingdoms. As someone who has not done anything in Game of Thrones, I'm just going to assume that Romance of the Three Kingdoms is better. So you can just get into that.
You know, at the very least, it's a story that has stood the test of time of centuries.
Yes.
So, yes, it has that over a book that came out 30 years ago. Yes.
Yeah, so plus you've got the book... There's actually multiple TV shows, a bunch of movies you can watch, and then you can start playing Dynasty Warriors. You can just go, there's so much Romance of the Three Kingdoms you can get into if you want your big, sprawling, historical, epic narrative with hundreds of characters in, and everybody you love gets killed. Because they're all people that lived, you know, 1,000+ years ago, like 2,000 years ago, so they all die. Like, of course they die, because they're actual people.
Yes.
So, you know, you get that. Everyone you get attached to, you know, dies.
Your bloodlust will be satiated.
Exactly. Like, Game of Thrones probably looks like pushy shit compared to fucking Romance Three Kingdoms. Because Game of Thrones can't have the balls to kill everybody because it's not based on history. In Romance Three Kingdoms, it doesn't matter how much of a protagonist a character is. If the fucker died, the fucker died and you just move on anyways.
All right. End Game of Thrones spoilers. Sean, tell us about your anime adventures. End us on a high note.
Yeah. So, about a month ago, I started watching a show called Armored Trooper Votoms. That's V-O-T-O-M-S. I cannot just explain to you why it's called Votoms, because they literally never say that word in the entire show. Because they call all the mechs Armored Troopers. So, it's a mech anime that came out in like 1982, I think. You have the 83. So the original show came out in 83, and there's a couple of OVA series and like extra movies and stuff that they have done, but it's mostly this one show that's 52 episodes long. For people who want some historical context, this is 3 years after the original Mobile Suit Gundam finished. And it's a couple of years before Zeta Gundam comes out. So, and it's by Sunrise, which is the same anime studio that made Gundam.
Oh, nice.
So, it's in this period of where Gundam comes in and sort of starts this new trend in mecha anime, which is they like called, quote-unquote, real robot shows. And that's like, you know, like the mecha genre starts becoming more grounded into sort of military fiction as opposed to the more sort of Power Rangers, Sentai kind of stuff it was before Gundam came in. And so this is in this like interesting transition period for the genre. I had heard that it was really cool and interesting, but it's fairly obscure, relatively speaking, as far as mecha shows go, especially in the West. Not a lot of people watch it. There is a Blu-ray that you can get. I just torrented it at some point because it was easier to do it that way. So I don't know if the Blu-ray is any good or not. But so it's 52 episodes, and it took me a long time to get through. My number one thing would be I like it quite a bit. It is way too long for what it is. Of those 52 episodes, about three of them are recaps. So it's not quite actually 52 episodes long. But even with like the 49 actual episodes of the show, it honestly should be probably about 25 episodes, because most episodes, about half of the episode is just taken up with fights, and the fights are very good, and the show looks fucking awesome, but it is, like, too long and spends too much time kind of wrapping in on itself. So the plotting is sort of very all over the place.
Can I give you an update on the Blu-ray?
Yeah.
It is a standard def Blu-ray, which means that it's just like the DVD files, but they're on Blu-ray, so they can do them on fewer discs.
Uh-huh.
A lot of anime have done this, especially in Japan, if they have not updated the masters. So that's probably fine. You get all the episodes, and it says, I think, does it say six movies? And six compilation movies on three discs.
Right, yes.
So, and it's only $25 on Amazon, so like, don't expect high def quality, but that actually sounds like a pretty good set.
Yeah,
so if you
want it, you can go the legit route. Because honestly, I was not planning, sort of like the exact same thing I did when I started watching Bubble Soup Gundam. I was not planning to watch all of the show. I was like, I'm kind of not watching anything. I'll check out like the first couple of episodes of Votoms. And then I just kind of got sucked into it because it gets very weird. So I now want to describe to you, Jonathan, in general, the plot of Votoms and where it goes, because it is fucking nuts.
I want you to do that, but first, on the Amazon page, it says that Votoms stands for Vertical One-Man Tanks for Offense and Maneuvers. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. You would only know that if you read the descriptions, because okay. Again, they never say that word in the whole show. Maybe, because I skipped the recaps, maybe there's some narration where they say Votoms. So that's where the word comes from? I don't know. Like, I feel like they just put it in there because you need some cool word. You need, like, Macross or Gundam or fucking Yurka or something to make your mech show sound cool, even though they don't ever use that word. Because what Armored Trooper Votoms is it is, for most of it, it's a fairly grounded mech show. Like, the Votoms themselves, or the Armored Troopers, the ATs is what they usually call them in the show, are really cool looking. They're, like, very tank-like. So they're much smaller scale than something like a Gundam. They're not big, bright colors like the Gundam and like Mobile Suits generally are. They're like military green, and they look like what if you took a World War II tank and turned it into like a mech suit. And that's the, sort of the tone the show generally likes to go for, is as this sort of more grounded war drama. And so it starts with, you're in some distant galaxy called the Asterigus Galaxy or something weird like that. And you're in the middle of some like 100-year war between the Balorant and the Gilgamesh forces. And the world building in this show is just all over the place. I never got a good sense of who the Balorant and the Gilgamesh are. And you follow in the first episode. And obviously, this is just to be said, if you are super desperately interested in watching the show unspoiled, you should not listen to this conversation. But if you listen to this conversation, you will want to watch the show more than if you hadn't heard it. So with that, I will continue ahead. The first episode, you meet your protagonist character, Kitako Kuvi, who is an elite soldier who's got blue hair, and I never liked his blue hair, and he's always wearing red suit. It's like he's the only character that has like really weird hair color, and it's just like I don't know why his hair is not either brown or black. But he has blue hair, and he's young. He's like 18 or something, and he's been fighting in this war. And he goes on this secret mission where he's part of the Gilgamesh forces, and it's this elite Gilgamesh task force that he has just joined that are doing this mission he doesn't quite understand to retrieve something from this asteroid base. And he finds out about halfway through the mission that they're actually attacking another Gilgamesh asteroid base, and so like the people he's working for are actually working for like they're part of some mysterious third faction. And in the middle of this mission, he discovers a strange naked woman who's just inside this glass tube, and he's like, what the fuck is this? And then she wakes up and stares at him, and he's like, what the fuck is going on? Why is there just a weird naked woman in the glass tube? And then he gets back into his armored trooper, and he gets blasted out into space because his troop has betrayed him, because he's supposed to be kind of like the fall guy for this heist. So he gets blasted out into space, he gets captured by the Gilgamesh military police, they torture him, try to figure out what the fuck was this mission, he escapes because he's a badass and nobody can stop Kitako, and he goes and escapes into a city called Wooming City. All of that happens in the first episode. It is such a super dense fucking episode of anime, because it's just a 22-minute episode. A lot of shit happens in that first episode.
I thought
you
were describing, like, the opening arc.
No, that's the first episode of this TV show. And then the pacing slows down dramatically, because then you have the rest of the show is basically split into four arcs that they call stages, and I think there's four compilation movies, and then probably the other two things are compilations of the OVA series they do afterwards on that Blu-ray. So then the first arc is Kitako in Wooming City. He meets some friends, Vanilla, Coconut, and Gotho, who are your sort of like supporting cast and kind of they're fun characters that are also comic relief. And that first arc is mostly him trying to sort of get his bearings and figure out what the fuck was with this weird lady and what was going on with this mission. He spends about four episodes basically doing nothing, and it's just like wandering around this weird Blade Runner city. Eventually, he finds her. She's in control. She's like awake and walking around now. She's just not a weird tube lady. And she's in control of the secret society that you now find out one of the major people running the secret society is a weird pope man who's wearing like a pope getup, and he has this whole weird church. This will be important like episode 47 when you find out like weird religion stuff starts coming in. At this point, it is utterly inexplicable. At this point, and through the point that the pope man dies, is utterly inexplicable why there's a fucking pope dude running all this shit. So, but there's this pope dude running all this shit. Kitako goes on all these adventures. Again, like, the show is so meandering and slowly paced that, like, this takes place over the course of, like, 12 episodes. Really, the only important stuff happens at, like, episode 10 or something in this arc, where he meets up with her again. They encounter each other. He finds out there's this thing called the Perfect Soldier Program that they then just start calling them PSs for the rest of the show. And she is part of this Perfect Soldier Program where they are manufacturing, like, people or, like, I never got a sense if they grew this lady or if they just kidnapped some kid and like it was like Spartan 2 Halo stuff and they like genetically modify her to make her so that she is like a perfect soldier and can defeat anybody. And Kitako finds out about that, gets a bunch of fights. He kills like a million cops in this city. There's just this like one episode, because basically the last episode of the Woman City arc is he finds out about the perfect soldier stuff. He wants to get her and like have her come with him because she imprinted on him the way like a chick does, like, you know, like a young like bird, where like because he was the first thing that she ever saw, her first memory is of this weird blue-haired dude like discovering her in this glass tube. She is like obsessed with him, and she has a memory of him before they like imprinted all their like evil military bullshit onto this perfect soldier lady. So she's obsessed with Kitako and just wants to be with him. But the society keeps her. In the fight where they keep her, Kitako just shouts out, "No, Fiona!" And he's like, "Fiona, why did I say that?" And it's like, I guess that's her name now. That will become important in like episode 50 of like, why did I just randomly fucking yell out the name Fiona?
Okay, Fiona, weird pope man.
Yes, Fiona and weird pope man. And so then Kitako gets in a massive fight, kills about a million cops, and the entire city just fucking explodes. Literally, this whole city is destroyed. They never address the fact that presumably hundreds of thousands of innocent people must have died in the explosion that destroyed this whole city. But when Armored Trooper Bottom says, we are done with this arc, they are done with that fucking arc and they blow up everything.
So it's like the end of Akira, but it's the first quarter of a series.
Yes, it's the first quarter of the series. And so much so that I didn't even know if like the supporting cast of Kokina and all the friends he meets would maintain to the other side of the show because their fate is left mysterious. But then the next episode starts up and all of a sudden you're basically just in Vietnam. And the next arc is like a whole Vietnam drama. So you go from like neo-noir Blade Runner City to we're in the fucking jungles of like Cayman, the Republic of Cayman. I forget what the name of it is. It's not important. He immediately in the next episode, he joins a paramilitary organization. It's been like months. And Kiriko's just wandering around. He's like, I don't know. All my friends are probably dead. I don't know where Fiona is. I'm just going to join this paramilitary organization called Assemble EX-10. Which is a great name, because Assemble is not a verb there. It's just part of the name, and it's not an acronym. They just always call it Assemble EX-10, because it's an English word that sounds cool, so they just use it. And so then Kiriko discovers that, one, his friend Gotho has just become a war profiteer, who he is now, he went from a junk dealer in Women City to a super rich multimillionaire war profiteer. And they never really address the morality of that situation at all. But Gotho's just like insanely rich now because he's selling weapons to people. And his other friends, Vanilla and Coconut, are running a bar in this like Saigon looking fucking city. And he just joins this whole war about this Vietnam shit. Totally conveniently, Fiona is there also on the enemy side. And so he's joined one side of this like civil war in this country. Fiona's on the other side. They have the Secret Society has now also created another perfect soldier named Ypsilon, who's a guy, and Ypsilon is sort of the guy that Kiriko just gets to fight like every other episode to have a cool fight with. Really, the second arc doesn't matter now that I'm thinking about it, other than he meets one character named Shaco, who is this really tall dude that they tell you is from the planet of Quaint, and he's a Quaintian, is how the subtitles translate, the Quaintogene, which sounds much better than a Quaintian. And then it's like, have you never fought with a Quaintian before? Like, they're this, like, you know, race of people that are really good mercenaries. And they never address again until the very last arc that there's just another race of people. Because everybody else is just a human. While you're in some other galaxy, there's not aliens running around. Everyone's just a human. But then there's this really tall dude named Shaco who looks like a human, but like Andre the Giant. And so you meet him. Other than that, there's just a civil war. Kiriko kills a bunch of people. The civil war ends. There's this cool dude who's like the king, who has sort of instigated the civil war, and he likes to fight people with this like cool spear, and it's called like balancing or something, because it's just an English word that sounds cool, even if it doesn't make sense. And he just gets in spear fights with people. Most of the supporting cast that get introduced in arc two, other than Shaco, are just killed over the course of that arc. Kiriko and Fiona continue to be friends, but they just can't quite be together until the very end. When the castle explodes this time that the king lives in, the king is killed in a balancing fight, and then Kiriko escapes with Fiona. All our other supporting cast are either dead or they also flee the planet, and Fiona and Kiriko flee out into space. And so those first two arcs are like pretty good, but Toru's kind of like standard mech anime fare that takes too long to get to the point. This is when the show starts getting very strange. They end up in space. Kiriko and Fiona alone, it's just the two of them on a shuttle, get picked up by another ship, a giant cruiser ship that's just floating in the middle of space, and they just get sucked into it, and they're there, and they get out, and they explore the ship, and nobody else is there. It's just the two of them on this ghost ship. They have no idea what it is, who it's from, why it picked them up. And then all of a sudden, a just like World War II propaganda style, just like news broadcast starts playing with like this big triumphant military theme that shows this massive massacre on some planet committed by the Red Shoulders, which were an elite group of Gilgamesh warriors. And you find out that Kiriko was a part of that group, and he has all this like PTSD war trauma stuff from fighting with the Red Shoulders. And the ship just starts playing these videos all of a sudden. And there's like three fucking episodes of this, them just on the ship alone. Kiriko is just kind of slowly going insane because it keeps on triggering his PTSD. Fiona has no idea what the fuck's going on. They keep on just trying to figure out what's going on with the ship and just, bleh, I don't know. They're just on this weird, crazy ghost ship that's just showing footage that is like very specifically targeted to Kiriko. And every time they like try to go to sleep, it'll just start blaring again, and it's just driving them crazy. then eventually the Balorant military, who are the other people that we have not seen, we've been with Gilgamesh people the whole time, they show up and they're like, oh, you've flown into the non-aggression zone. And it gets very Star Trek all of a sudden with like Romulan, like non-aggression type shit. The Balorant start... Zone. Yeah, the neutral zone. And so the Balorant start attacking. Kitako and Fianna fight them off because this is also where Fianna starts getting medical reports because she's trying to figure out what's going on with Kitako, and she finds out that he had this wound, like this gunshot wound, that just was like healed incredibly quickly. She's like, what the fuck's going on? And this is the first hint you get that Kitako's not just a really good soldier, but there's something else going on with him. Eventually, Kitako and Fianna fight off the Balorant. They crash land on this other planet that you find out is the planet from the video that the Red Shoulders have like completely destroyed. And then you have a long arc where Kitako has to sort of deal with his war trauma on this planet. He meets a lady whose whole family was killed by the Red Shoulders, and it kind of gets normal again. And you're like, okay, the stuff on that ship got very weird and psychological in a way that like was not what this show was going for. Now this is just Kitako running around like murdering a bunch of people, and at the end of the arc, everything just explodes. That's like, okay, Bottoms, I get you, just everything's blowing up. In that part is where the other perfect soldier, Ypsilon, gets killed, and that's a fun fight. Then you go to the planet of Quaint. So Kitako finds out that he starts finding out that there's something weird about me. And when he defeats Ypsilon, who is the other perfect soldier, he's like, no normal human should be able to defeat a perfect soldier. It would be like a Marine in Halo being able to defeat the Master Chief. And everyone's like, that is fucked up, dude. Like, you shouldn't... Like, what's going on with you? Like, Fianna kind of lets it loose that it's like, there was a weird thing in your medical report. Kitako meets up again with this weird, mysterious character who was the officer that was initially interrogating him back in episode 1, kind of shows up again, but he has now switched sides to the Balorant, and he seems to know everything about everybody. Also, I forgot to mention, the Pope guy had died a while ago also. He's dead. So forget about the Pope man. Instead of the Pope man, who is our secret society guy, we have two twins that have like this weird bowl cut that are always finishing each other's sentences and are just trying to run science experiments. So we abandoned the Pope man for science twins. And so now Kitako started finding out there's something weird about him. He can't possibly be a normal human. And this weird officer who changed from Gilgamesh to Balorant's like, oh, Kitako, I know everything, but you best go to the planet of Quaint, and that's where you'll discover the secret of all this bullshit. And I'm sitting here thinking, like, what the fuck? Like, this show has not given any hint that there's some great secret overriding everything else. And now all of a sudden it's like there's some crazy secret about Kitako. He arrives on the planet of Quaint. He meets up with Shaco again. He goes through this whole, like, weird, almost like spirit vision thing where he meets an ancient Quaint elder dude who's, like, all wrinkled and he seems like he's 100 years old. And you start finding out that on the planet of Quaint, the Quaintian people are, like, isolated. Only a couple of them leave the planet to become mercenaries. And they have basically abandoned all technology and civilization. And you find out that buried underneath that planet are all these ancient technological ruins that have been buried for, like, 3,000 years. And none of them know really what it is or what they're there for. You find out that one time in the past, a giant fleet, like, spaceship fleet, attacked the planet of Quaint. And all the ships were, mysteriously destroyed. It's like, okay, this is all weird shit. And you start delving down, and they go into the ruins, and then whenever like the evil science twins start sending in armored troopers to go attack them, anything mechanical that activates inside those ruins just gets mysteriously teleported to somewhere else on the planet. So there's all this weird ancient technology bullshit going on. Eventually, what you find out through all this weird like traveling around and doing all this shit and talking to all these people is that there is an ancient mysterious being called Wise Man, who is from 3,000 years ago, who has been manipulating all the events in the universe. Eventually you find out he's the guy that sent the ship to capture Kitako because he's testing Kitako. Because what you find out is Kitako's not a human, nor is he a perfect soldier. He is what is called an Overman. He's an Overman, which is a genetic modification that will happen every 3,000 years. Someone will be born as an Overman. There was an ancient race of people that lived on the planet of Quaint called the Children of God. Wise Man was one of the overmen of the Children of God. And the Quaintian people who were like the normal inhabitants of the planet of Quaint, sort of overthrew the children of God and defeated them and thought that they were all dead. But Wise Man sealed himself deep inside the technological ruins inside the planet of Quaint, and he turned himself into an AI that rules over everything and is effectively God. And so Wise Man, one, orchestrated all the war that was going on, like the Hundred Years' War between the Balrog and the Gilgamesh. That was all Wise Man, because he thinks that only through war can humanity progress, and he wants to generate another Overman. So he wants to push humanity to like the next point of evolution so that he can rest and have a new Overman take over for Wise Man to become the ruler of the galaxy. And so Kitako is this like one in a million genetic freak that like is the Overman born from the tragedies of war that can now become replace Wise Man. So Wise Man both instigated that war, then he also created the secret society. And that's why the Pope Man is there, is because they all worship Wise Man as a god. Because with his magical super technology, he's just able to communicate directly with anybody, anytime across the galaxy. So Wise Man has created multiple different agents, both within the Gilgamesh and the Balrog, and with the secret society to try to orchestrate the scenario where he can find out who is the Overman that's out there to replace me. He also then, in that process, is the one who gives the technology to some of the people to then create perfect soldiers, because one of the reasons why the Children of God went extinct is because the Quaint people didn't like that they were genetically modifying people to make perfect soldiers, and so they overthrew them. So that's how the whole perfect soldier thing comes into the loop. Kitako finds out in a meeting with Wise Man that takes place on a magic asteroid base that kind of looks like a Borg cube, that he's supposed to be the successor to Wise Man and take over as God of the universe. And Kiriko's like, fucking, that sounds awesome. Yeah, I will take on all of your power, Wise Man. So then Wise Man bestows the entirety of all this power of the secret society to Kiriko. But now that means that Kiriko has to go back to the planet of Quaint. So he's on Quaint, found out about Wise Man, had to go to an asteroid to talk to Wise Man. He finds out on that magic asteroid that Wise Man is actually in the heart of the planet of Quaint, so he has to go back to Quaint. And that's one of those things of where this show likes to waste your fucking time sometimes. Kitako goes back to Quaint to take over the mantle for Wise Man. He spends one episode just basically murdering. Because all Balrog and Gilgamesh find out about this shit, and they're like, okay, well, we don't want to be ruled over by God, so let's go kill Kitako. So they send their combined forces to kill Kitako. Kitako just basically massacres all of them because he's the Overman. How can you possibly kill the Overman? Kitako fights into the heart of the city, of the planet. In the process, he's also basically abandoning all of his friends that he's made along the way. He ends up shooting Shaco in the leg and the shoulder, because Shaco's like, no, you can't do it. You can't take over. You can't be one of the children of God. This is impossible. And it's a very, like, Obi-Wan Anakin kind of scene, but if Anakin just shot fucking Obi-Wan in the leg. And Shaco's like, no! And then all the Kiriko's other friends are like, what the fuck are you doing, Kitako? We're gonna leave you. Fianna is the only one that stays with him because she's, like, obsessed with him and in love with him. But then eventually she realizes that he's going down the dark path and tries to stop him. And then they fight each other in ATs. And he shoots her in the AT and she gets teleported away because they're inside the magic technology base that has all the teleportation shit. So now it's just Kitako. And he starts climbing up a mountain of ancient technology because Wise Man says, I am at the top. You must get to the top of this mountain. And there I will bestow to you all of my powers. And you shall become my replacement. And you shall be God. And you shall rule over this galaxy and continue this infinite war. Because you are the one who knows war better than anybody. Kitako starts climbing it. He starts becoming exhausted. And like halfway up the mountain, he's like, I can't climb anymore. It's too much. And Wise Man's like, what do you mean? Like, you have come so far. You've abandoned so much. It's very sort of Thanos and the Soul Stone sort of shit starts happening. He's like, you've sacrificed everything for this. How could you possibly stop now for your power? And it's like, please, Wise Man, I just want to be able to see you. And so Wise Man sort of says like, well, you can't see me because I am not one individual. I'm actually an AI. And then if you just get up to here, like, this is where he lowers this thing. Like, if you get this, will bestow to you all of my power. And that's where Kitako, who has been basically just evil for 5 episodes, even though you probably don't believe that he's been evil, he's like, okay, now he pulls out a gun, shoots the Wise Man's magic box that would make him a god. Wise Man's like, what the fuck are you doing? Why would you shoot that? Kitako springs up, and then it's just like 10 minutes of the scene from 2001 A Space Odyssey where Dave pulls out all the AI cores for HAL, and it's the most straight play ripoff of anything I have ever fucking seen. And there's a lot of 2001 A Space Odyssey shit in Gundam. That one of the reasons I want you to watch Gundam is I think you're going to love that fucking shit. But Gundam sort of makes it its own thing. Bottom's just like, no, we're gonna 10 fucking solid minutes of pulling out these AI cores while Wise Man's like, no, Kiriko, what are you doing? You can't do that. Please, Kiriko. No, I'm afraid. And he's just pulling out all these things. The weird dude who showed up that's like been kind of playing both sides shows up, and Fianna fucking judo chops him in the neck and knocks him out, which is a pretty good part, because Fianna shows up and she's like, I knew you couldn't be bad because you didn't shoot to kill me, you just shot me to knock me into the teleporter. And so then Kiriko and Fianna both pull out all the AI cores and escape. It then cuts to 1 year later. War is starting up again in the galaxy. Kiriko literally killing God. It ends with the thing that the guy who's like was worshipped, the interrogation officer who's playing all the sides, the last thing he says is like, what are you doing, Kiriko? You could have had all this power. You literally just killed God. He just said, you just killed God. Kiriko's killed God 1 year later. That has not stopped humanity from getting into all these ancient infinite wars. All Kiriko's friends attack a military base. And they get this capsule that you find out that Kiriko and Fianna together are in this capsule naked. You never find out why. I just assume they must have been captured because they're perfect soldiers and people wanted to use them in these wars. Kiriko and Fianna decide, we can't be in this world. You know, we can't live in a world where people are fighting because we're perfect soldiers and we're like the ultimate weapons. Well, she's the perfect soldier. He's the Overman. It's different. Like, Overmen are not made through technology. They are made, they're forged in the fires of war and tragedy. And so they decide, you're just shoot us off into space inside this capsule, naked, holding each other, and we will be frozen until we make the OVA series in the 90s that is a sequel to Armored Trooper Bottoms. And it ends with a big projection of like an overlay of Kiriko and Fianna cradling each other over like the galaxy, and then the end pops up in the corner, and it's the most bonkers fucking shit.
Now, why is she called Fianna? You said you're going to get to that.
She is called Fianna because Wise Man is the one who gave them the perfect soldier technology. And I think he says something to the effect of, like, I have, like, given you this knowledge. And I feel like he is communicating to Kiriko and has been influencing Kiriko's life over the course of, like one of the things that Kiriko has been, like, kind of keeps on getting out of scrapes all the time, and it's, like, he's a little bit too lucky. And Wise Man sort of implies that I have been manipulating things to kind of keep you alive, and in that moment, I whispered in your ear, basically, the name Fianna, because that's her name, because since I'm God, and I've given them the technology of perfect soldierdom, they have made her, like, as I've, like, wanted her to be. And because he specifically wants Kiriko and Fianna, because he also orchestrated events, I'm just realizing this now, that, like, he must have been the guy, the mysterious thing that, like, the reason why Kiriko was in this task force, even though nobody else knew that he was supposed to be there. It was just like, why are you here, Kiriko? Like, you're this, like, famous soldier dude, but I don't get why you're on this mission. You don't know anything about this mission. Is because Wise Man wanted Kiriko to be imprinted on Fianna because he needed Kiriko to experience love, because it was only through experiencing love that he could get to the next stage of becoming an Overman, because he already knew the tragedies of war, but he didn't know true sacrifice yet. So, like, part of the thing to become the next Wise Man and ascend from a child of God to the actual God of the universe was he needed to be able to sacrifice the person that he loved. But of course, Kiriko could never actually do that.
I have so many thoughts.
Uh-huh.
I'm gonna have three here I want to do.
Okay.
First, this sounds like the Japanese version of Dune.
Yes!
With like Muad'Dib, but it's the Overman.
Yes!
That's what this sounds
like. It's very much got that kind of vibe, only the first half of it is like, or the first fourth of it is Blade Runner weird shit. The second fourth of it is like Apocalypse Now. There's a whole part in the Vietnam shit where they're, like, going down a river and they have a commanding officer who's just an asshole who's, like kind of always, like, doesn't trust anybody and starts, like, kind of killing civilians and stuff. It's so Apocalypse Now for, like, fucking 10 episodes for no reason. And then it starts becoming, like, weird Dune. Yes.
Okay, second, I want the American movie of this.
Uh-huh.
I want it to be called Overman. That's the movie's title. And I know that Kiryu is supposed to be like 18.
Kiriko
is supposed to be 18, but I want to age him up, and he's played by Keanu Reeves, and Keanu Reeves is the Overman.
Yeah.
That's why I don't want them to do it all in one 2-hour movie. And
it's
just
so absurd. It's just, it's because it, like, I can't stress enough how none of that shit about the Overman and God and the AI, like, none of that is in, like, the first, like, 30 episodes of this fucking show. It's like the
amazing.
Like the first hint of it you get is them getting picked up by this mysterious ship that's playing all these clips. But I just assumed that must be like someone from like the Balorant side or something, because they start introducing the Balorant people. It's like, oh, they must see some weird general for the Balorant that like fought Kiriko in a past battle and he's like trying to fuck with him. I didn't think it was literally God and that this would end with the most JRPG of all bullshit, which is Kiriko fucking kills God, but in the scene from 2001 A Space Odyssey where they disable Hal. There's even full straight up in that sequence, there's just a shot of like a lens that is like the round lens that takes up the full screen. It's not red, but other than it not being red, it is the exact shot from fucking 2001 A Space Odyssey. It is amazing the level of detail they go to just replicate that sequence wholesale.
Third,
yeah,
this is how I want Game of Thrones to end, is Daenerys, at the beginning of the next episode, she is approaching the throne room to finally take her seat on the Iron Throne after she's committed her genocide, and the Night King is waiting there for her, the King of the Zombies, who we thought was dead, and it turns out he is the wise man, and Daenerys, her entire role was to become the Overman. And they have this meeting, and I think Daenerys just, she doesn't kill her, she just takes it, yeah, and she becomes the Overman.
There's a part of me that, like, They play that Kiriko being evil for so much longer than anything ever would. It's a solid 4 to 5 episodes of the show that goes from Kiriko finding out he's supposed to be the successor and decides, like, oh, like, you know, you... Because I assumed in the moment, there's no way that he is actually doing this for real. But they spent so long on it, I legitimately started to waver of, like, does this show just end with Kiriko becoming God?
Because that's what I wanted when you were describing it. That's like the Dune thing. You know?
Yeah, like, it's like, it skirts so close to that. There's part of this, like, it would be the most fucked up thing for the end of this show to be he kills all of his friends, including Fianna. Like the only way I can describe it is particularly when he starts fighting Fianna, it felt for a while like somehow they made an anime adaptation of like the bad end of like, or like if you chose the evil path in like a BioWare RPG,
yeah,
or like Infamous Second Son, where it's like it makes no sense that all these people are just he's just evil. It's just it's like the end of Dice of the Republic. If you become Darkseid, you just start murdering all your friends you've been with. It's like this makes no sense. What the fuck is going on? But they could possibly spend 5 fucking episodes with Kiriko just pretending to be evil. It's been so long. The other thing I did describe is at the end of each episode of Armored Trooper Bottoms, you have the next on Bottoms thing plays, which is typical for anime. But instead of it being like the normal thing of like, here's like a narrator that's maybe one of the characters or just an abstract narrative voice, like describing in a couple of lines some of the major plot beats to kind of tease you for the next episode, the way that like an episode of Dragon Ball Z ends. It's not like that. Every time an Armored Trooper Bottoms episode ends, it says, like, next on Armored Trooper Bottoms, it's just the narrator waxing poetical about the most random bullshit for, like, a solid minute.
That sounds great.
None of it makes any sense. It rarely, like, particularly connects to what is actually happening. It's never something of, like, there's a straightforward sentence describing what's going on. Because he doesn't say the names of the characters either. And so, like, the way they translate is always, like, and someone will ascend to the throne of power for the children of God, forged in the fires of war, who have experienced the love and the hate of the universe, shall see to the utmost conclusion the events of all the tragedy and the heartbreak that the universe has seen. And it's just like, what the fuck are you even talking about? It's like, none of that even happens in the next episode. It just plays over clips, because usually you just, like, if you want to see what is next on, you just have to infer based on the clips they show and just ignore the weird, like, and roses which bloom from the blood of the fallen shall tower over the battlefield of hatred and love in the history of warfare and the future of darkness. It's like, what the fuck are you saying, dude? It's great. Armored Trooper Bottoms is so weird. Like I think the main reason why I wanted to spoil it for people is because I think most people would not make it through to where the show starts turning if you didn't know that it would start turning. Because very lugubrious. It takes its time. But once it starts getting weird, it gets weird. And I also do want to emphasize the fights are fucking awesome, because this show, like half of every single episode is just a long expanded fight scene. And Kiriko must kill like 1,000 people just direct. Like, not like, oh, like this bomb went off and some people died. Like, just shooting different other armored troopers. I think I was looking around for like what a like every like a compilation of every kill in Armored Trooper Bottoms from Kiriko was, and I think it was something like a solid like 12 minutes of footage of just him shooting people.
They spell his name super fucking weird in English. Why is it Chirico?
I don't know. Yeah, it's C H I R I C O. It's Kiriko QV. C-U-V-I-E. Yeah. I don't like his name. I don't like the way the character looks. It's also the show does have a very significant issue with like Kiriko looking very off model a lot of times. It's like it feels like every third episode or so, his face just looks completely different. But he has such a and like generic anime protagonist face that it's not a big problem, but it's very funny. Like you could tell that the time budget for the show was very stretched because they have a recap episode. They have two recap episodes that take place during the Woman City arc. Like, so once you get to the Vietnam section, there are two recap episodes that happen in the Vietnam section, recapping stuff that happened in the Woman City arc. And there's no, like, it's not like the recap episodes that are, here's some extra narration that adds other context. It's just the clip show of things that you saw from like 10 episodes ago. It's the two most unnecessary recap episodes I've ever seen in an anime.
And that's on top of the OVA recap things, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's so they did the thing that like a lot of things do, which are compilation movies that take the like different arcs together and cut them together. Yeah. Like Gundam has three of those.
Wow.
Yeah, Armature. Wow. I just had to talk about it. Because again, because the show is paced so slowly, I could only watch a maximum of like three episodes a day. And so it's been much slower going for me watching Bottoms than most anime. And I've been living with it for a long time. And it's like, I've been wanting to talk about it on the podcast, but not sure what to say about it. And then I finished it last night. And like, I have to fucking bring this up because this is the most... I watched the last five episodes in a row. Like, I had to finish it in one big swoop, because once they started talking about the Overman stuff, I'm like, I have to just do this all in one big thing. I'm not going to be able to hold all the crazy bullshit this show's doing. Because that's obviously, like, my explanation of the plot is skipping, like, fuck, so much.
I need to watch this. Happening. I need to, oh my god, Sean.
You have to watch Gundam first.
Okay.
Because one, I think Gundam will give you some of the genre context that will make Bottoms better for you. And when we do the Mobile Suit Gundam podcast that now we have to do, since I'm going to do Game of Thrones and you're going to watch Gundam, I will explain to you the history of Mecha, and then you can move on to Armored Trooper Bottoms to understand how fucking crazy this show is.
Man, oh man. Okay, this is great. My new prediction for the end of Game of Thrones, I mean, I know how it ends because I read the leaks, but if we're pretending I didn't read the leaks, my prediction is Daenerys becomes the Overman.
Yeah.
We'll be back next week. We'll talk John Wick. We'll talk Detective Pikachu. But man, I don't think we're going to be able to top that Armored Trooper Bottom segment.
Yeah, no, but now I just have to... Now I'm committed. Now, because this is the other question, Jonathan. That's not the last Bottom thing that is made. There are multiple... No, I looked.
There's like a billion things.
Yeah, there are a couple of side stories, but there are multiple OVA series that happen that take place after the events of Armored Trooper Bottoms. And I had to know if Kiriko was going to be in it. And I downloaded and looked at and just like looked at little clips from the Shining Heresy, I think it's called, that takes place after Bottoms, and Kiriko is in it. So now I'm so committed, because how the fuck do you keep on telling a story about the dude who is basically God, who decided not to become God and killed AI God? What is the sequel to that story? I'm going to find out.